Welcome. This meeting is called to order August 23rd, 2017 at 9:15 a.m. Before proceeding with our business, I believe Mr. Smith has a statement to make.
I do, Mr. Chairman. Commissioners, a public notice of this meeting containing all items on the proposed agenda has been filed in the Office of the Secretary of State as required by Chapter 551 Government Code, referred to as Open Meetings Act. I'd like for this fact to be noted in the official record of the meeting. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Carter. Next is approval of the minutes from the previous work session held on May 24th, 2017, which have already been distributed. Do we have a motion for approval? Moved by Commissioner Latimer. Second, Commissioner Morian. All in favor? Any opposed? Hearing none, motion carries. Work session item number one is the update on Texas Parks and Wildlife Department progress in implementing the TPWD Land and Water Resources Conservation and Recreation Plan. Mr. Carter Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioners, for the record, my name is Carter Smith with the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. Mr. Chairman, I'm going to be uncharacteristically brief this morning, so time me. First and foremost, very pleased to welcome a few new faces. Some are familiar, some aren't, to some new roles inside the department. I'll start to my left, Ms. Angie Gonzalez-Sanchez, who's been with us almost 20 years, started in law enforcement and was then working with state parks, was basically the right hand for Wes Masseur, our director of law enforcement, and Angie has taken on Dee's former role. And so we're excited to have her as part of the team, and she'll be working closely with the commission going forward. So, Angie, welcome. Also, Dr. Pamela Wheeler, our new HR director. And so Pamela has started work now. It's been all of 6 weeks or so, something like that. We're thrilled to have her on the team as our new HR director, and so I hope that y'all have a chance to meet her. Bob Sweeney, our general counsel. Where is Bob sitting over here? Obviously, Bob, no stranger to the commission, and very pleased to welcome him to his new role with the department. And last but not least, our new colonel, Graham Jones. And so Graham has taken over that colonel role. So we're excited about that and honored to welcome everybody to the team. So thank you. Yeah. Mr. Chairman, obviously, is required by law. Let me just give a very quick synopsis of our internal affairs team. John and his team continue to do a remarkable job in that regard. Obviously, y'all are aware that Brad Chappell finally made retirement official, and so that gave us an opportunity then to recruit and hire a new captain with internal affairs. That captain is Mark Hammond. Mark has had a very distinguished career as a game warden inside the department. Most recently, he was a lieutenant at the Game Warden Training Center there in Hamilton. Prior to that, Mark was based in Hill County, where he certainly served with distinction. And he's going to be officing out of the Fort Worth office. And so, Craig and Graham, we appreciate that accommodation. It'll be nice to have an officer up there in that regard. So y'all will have a chance to meet and welcome Mark to the team. Last thing I'll say about internal affairs, Jonathan is working on a year-end summary of the caseload and activities of that team, and so he ought to have that buttoned up by the end of September, and then we'll have that distributed to the commission for your review. And as always, if you've got any questions about it, don't hesitate to query Jonathan or myself. A quick update on Desert Bighorn Sheep. You know, obviously one of the great flagship projects of the department, and Mitch and Clayton and Bob and Froy and the whole team that have been working out there in West Texas on this, obviously have achieved a lot of milestones. They just finished up the Bighorn Sheep surveys, I think last week for the region, although I guess they've got some at Elephant Mountain going on this week. The news that I want to share with y'all, we have a couple of planned sheep captures for this fall, and would love to get those on your calendars if you're able to come out to West Texas to see it. It's very, very impressive. We plan to translocate a fair amount of sheep from Elephant Mountain to Black Gap, the wildlife management area right there on the Rio Grande, what our team calls that South Brewster County population. Prior to that translocation, our team is going to be trapping 30 sheep at Black Gap. They're going to fit them with satellite transmitters. They're going to take hair and blood and fecal samples and nasal swabs. They want to look at disease and parasites and genetic-related information. They'll also submit that sample to a Western sheep disease database, Bob, I guess. And I just want to make sure that that population is clean and disease-free before we end up moving maybe as many as 100 sheep down there from Elephant Mountain to Black Gap later on in December. The satellite transmitters obviously will give us real-time information to be able to track home range and movements and habitat use and selection, also looking at things like mortality and predation. So excited about this this chapter of the Bighorn Sheep Program. And again, if you can get any of these dates on your calendar, we'd invite any and all commissioners to come join us for that. So, yeah, Commissioner Jones.
Carter, who monitors the movement, the data
that's
transmitted by those collars?
Yeah. Are we doing that, or is Borderlands Research Institute? Mitch? Both. Okay, so our staff, along with our partners at Soil Ross through the Borderlands Research Institute, so it'll be a partnership, and Soil Ross has been part and parcel of a lot of these efforts from a scientific perspective. So.
And do our staff monitor it there in the county, or is that transmitted all the way back here to Austin?
Yeah, you can access it wherever, and so that's the beauty of those satellite transmitters, is you can monitor those collared individuals remotely and be able to track them real time in terms of their movements. So enormously beneficial. We'll get a artesian well of data from that. So very, very, very helpful. Anything else, guys? Okay. Anyway, please take a look at the calendar, and we'd love to have you out there for that. Last but not least, I just want to thank Chairman Morian, who oversees the Farm and Ranchland Conservation Program for the department. You will recall that in 2016, that program was moved from the General Land Office to Parks and Wildlife. That is essentially a program to acquire, through a voluntary basis, conservation lands to help protect working lands, farms, and ranches around the state. We get a lot of other ancillary benefits from that in terms of water quality and water quantity and habitat and open space related values. But it's a farm and ranch land program, and so that's the genesis of it. The council has had now two different appropriations over two different biennia of roughly $2 million a year. Chairman Morian can certainly chime in, but the leverage and outcomes have been terrific. We've had great participation by the land trust community and private landowners. They have done 14 projects in 11 counties from the coast through the Hill Country out to West Texas. And for every state dollar that has gone into that program, it's been leveraged over 7-1. And as a result, there's over 26,000 acres permanently conserved around the state. So very, very pleased about that. I want to thank Ted Hollingsworth and Ross and Jeannie and the whole team that have been working on that. So, Chairman Morian, you want to add anything to that?
No, it's just an extraordinarily successful program. And like I said, the leverage is what's so attractive. The last go-around, it was almost 8-1. So.
We're making headway.
Yeah. It's a great program.
Only limitation is money. With that, Mr. Chairman, that concludes my remarks this morning. And so I'm happy to address any other issues or questions that y'all may have.
Any other questions for Carter?
Right. Carter, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Appreciate it.
Item number two is a financial overview. Fiscal year 2018 operating and capital budget approval, budget and investment policy resolutions, and approval of state park list for performance measures. Mr. Mike Jensen, morning.
Morning, Chairman, Commissioners. This is the annual meeting. I'm going to go a little bit slower today than I'll go tomorrow. Tomorrow will be the afternoon where we have the motion. We have a number of housekeeping items that we generally go over with the operating budget. This slide here kind of tells you what those items are. I'm going to crosswalk for you the General Appropriations Act, how we created the budget, what the legislature approved. We'll break that down by division with FTEs, and we'll very high-level summarize the full-time equivalent FTE employee cap. We'll have a couple slides on the capital budget, and we'll have a housekeeping item, the annual approval of the budget policy for the commission, annual approval of the investment policies. And at the start of each biennium, we have an approval, a starting point for the LBB performance measure related to the state parks list, and we'll get your approval for that. I'll have a slide about one particular bill, House Bill 448, and then I will conclude the presentation. Moving forward, we'll crosswalk to the General Appropriations Act for 2018. You see the first line on here, we have $385.03 million that we start with. We consider that our baseline budget. We're in Article 6 of the Appropriation Bill, along with other natural resource agencies. And this is really the net of a lot of different things. When we submitted our legislative appropriations request, we had a base in there. We had a 4% reduction of almost $23 million. That's already included here. They zeroed out our unexpended balance where we could move capital construction monies from 17 into 18. We don't have any UB authority for general revenue or the state parks account or for Fund 9. We do have some for other funds. This also includes the exceptional items that were approved. One item was $17 million in deferred maintenance. I think this was the House's way of giving back some funding for taking away the unexpended balance. We have $1 million for law enforcement's capital transportation, $49.2 million for weather-related capital construction damage repairs. And we have the centralized accounting and payroll system from the comptroller's office, $802,000 to kick that project off. Border security money, instead of having an interagency contract with DPS, they directly funded $7 million for that effort for law enforcement. They gave us $4 million to replace that 35-year-old 65-foot vessel. And one item that's reflected in our bill pattern is another reduction of $1.8 million. There's an informational provision in Article 9. It's called contract cost containment. But all of that is netted together, so we have $385.03 million. In addition to that, there's some monies that are not reflected in our Article 6. There's some contingency legislation. And two of those, one of them relates to consolidating the shrimp buyback program into Fund 9. That's about $1.17 million. Then we have the Lifetime License Endowment. This was the last moment bill that was passed that opens up that endowment for this biennium, $8 million. So that $8 million plus $1.17 reflects this $9.17 million adjustment there. That's what that is. In the past, we provided our own estimate based upon historical study of fringe benefits. This time we're just using exactly what's in the appropriation bill. We feel that's slightly inflated, but we actually only record actuals on that. So the third line item is $75.07 million reflects the fringe benefit replacement pay. And our total budget is $469.27 million to kick off 2008.
How much was taken out of the Article 9 for future repairs that was not allowed to roll over?
Our UV was approximately $18.65 million. Which does create serious logistical concerns, Jessica can tell you. I think that's why the House gave us the $17 million of deferred maintenance. But giving us a brand-new appropriation, the expectation is we're going to work on a new project with a brand-new appropriation. The reality is we needed that money to finish up things that have already been designed that are construction in progress. But we can use some of the Article 9 provision from Lifetime License Endowment, the $8 million. $4 million of that is going to be intended to replace law enforcement boats. $3.5 million, we have a plan that we've presented back to the Legislative Budget Board to use that for a quasi-type of UB to finish out Fund 9 projects that are in place right now that are not quite finished. And another $500,000 would be for some easements needed for wildlife areas at Caddo Lake. This next slide relates more to your Exhibit A on page 11 of your commission books. It reflects the method of finance on that exhibit. It directly ties again to the Article 6 base, the amounts that we just had with the adjustments for Article 9 in fringe of $469.27 million. You can see general revenue is about 34%. Our Fund 9, Game Fish and Water Safety, is about 29%. State Parks accounts about 12% of the budget. You have general revenue dedicated other about 2%, and federal funds is 16%, and other funds is 7%. We believe that the estimate that the Legislative Budget Board provided for federal funds is highly optimistic, so we did not allocate that through all divisions. We're holding what we think was too much in the department-wide budget. I have a slide for that. We'll walk through that later. One thing that's not in here, you'll see sporting goods sales tax. We talk about that a lot. Sporting goods sales tax is reflected in the general revenue piece. I want the commission to know that we do have an informational rider that's available to the public and to everybody, rider number 16. It walks through dollar for dollar what was available for the Historic Commission and Parks and Wildlife out of sporting goods sales tax. The comptroller's estimate, the maximum amount that could be allocated is $333.5 million. 94% of that, which could be allocated to Parks and Wildlife, is $313.5. Out of the $313.5 million that was available, the legislature in Rider 16 does provide $277.6 million. That's 88.5%. So that's actually pretty good. It's not 100% like we wanted, but it's better than historically what was provided in the past 10 years or so, with the exception of this biennium where we had 100%. Moving on to the operating budget summaries, the first slide ties to your Exhibit B, which is on page 13 of your commission books. That exhibit in your books has a column for each one of these line items here. So you see salaries and other personnel costs of $169.3 million. You'll see a column for operating, grants, capital budget, debt service, and fringe benefits, and how that's broken out. The following slides are going to break that down by division with also the number of budgeted FTEs by division. The only one that doesn't have a lot of detail here is the grants. About half of that is a local park grant, sporting goods sales tax, some of the farm and ranch land monies. About 29% of the grants relate to recreational trail grants and state wildlife grants. And 14% is some grants that we have related to the game bird stamps. If we look at this by division, I'm not going to read. This is in your exhibit on page 13. What I do want to call your attention to is the FTEs that are listed here reflect budgeted FTEs. We do have an FTE cap that's in the appropriation bill, but it doesn't put a cap per division, but we track that internally. Any division can budget above that cap, and many divisions do. It's our responsibility as a division and as an agency to manage within that cap as we have retirements and vacancies. In Article 9, a Section 6.10 provision, Article 9 is a part of the appropriation bill that applies to all state agencies. It provides general guidance for a state classification plan. And the latter sections are where you have contingency riders for bills that are out there. This is one provision for an agency of our size that gives us flexibility of plus 50 over the FTE cap. Historically, that hasn't been an issue for this department. We did lose this agency-specific rider where we were able to average our FTEs over the biennium, but we're not that close, so it shouldn't be that much of a problem in this biennium. And this slide just continues. I couldn't fit them all on one. Again, the budget's $469.27 million. The budgeted FTEs are $3,232.3, and the actual cap is $3,149.2. And I'll just walk you back into history. Back around 1415, the cap was $3,109.2. The 84th legislative session gave us 34 additional FTEs, if you recall. Two were for coastal habitat monitoring, two for farm and ranch land program, five were for aquatic invasives, 19 for game wardens along the border, and six for state parks. And that's how we got to the cap that we're currently in 2017 at 3,143. This past legislative session, the CAPS HR project, it gave us an additional authority for six FTEs, and that's reflected on this slide. The department-wide budget, as we presented and briefed in the past, this is a placeholder. It's not really a division, but if we have a program that benefits the agency as a whole, we tend to budget this in a central location. And some of the items that are in here are payments to our licensed vendors and to the vendor who runs the license system for us. We budget those monies there, so we have $6.95 million there. The debt service and master lease payments. The debt service is roughly $3 million. Master lease payments about $70,000. $3 million there. Those are debt service on bonds from 1998 that were revenue bonds for state parks. This negative amount for strategic reserve, this is not a real call for concern. What this reflects here, historically, the state parks division has had to manage within their operation budget. They had to project what they thought was going to be salary lapse in order to operate. What we've done in building their budget for this fiscal year, for this biennium, we've put more funding in their budget for operations so that they won't have to account for lapse from day one. We're going to be managing that centrally now. The next line item, storm payment, is about $875,000. Airport commerce is for our facility that's about 3 miles from here, and that's the lease cost for $681,000. Headquarter utility and the fleet and other costs are roughly $348,000. We have some pass-through plates that we budget here for $126,000. The CAPS HR project, we're budgeting this for this fiscal year in DWID for $652,000. And when I started, I'd mentioned that we believe they were highly optimistic with their federal funds to the tune of about $23.9 million. We're holding that authority here in the DY. We don't want to pass it out. We don't want divisions overspending. Should the apportionments be higher, then we will allocate those budgets at the time of those apportionments, and those divisions will get a budget increase at that time. So the DY budget is $35.98 million. Capital budget, we have a number of riders. And this, again, this ties to your Exhibit B on page 13. We have a Rider 2, a Rider 3, and a 4 that give the commission and the public more information as to what capital is. The main rider that people look at is Rider 2. It's the capital rider that we have. So if you look at this column called capital budget, all those numbers tie to a dollar to rider number 2 in our bill pattern. The UB amount there, that reflects other funds. It reflects some federal funds. appropriated receipts, interagency contracts, bond proceeds. So we do have UB, but we don't have UB for general revenue or for the state park account or for Fund 9 account. So the first line on there, $71.52 million, that's rider number two, plus rider number four UB amount, plus $3.5 million out of Article 9, the lifetime license endowment, section 18.26. Parks minor repair is rider number two, paragraph B, $4.29 million. The third item, information technology and data center, that's rider two, paragraph C and paragraph G. Transportation items is rider two, paragraph D, plus $4 million that we've mentioned from the lifetime license endowment. Capital equipment is from rider 2E, the $1.5 million. And master lease, the small amount there, is paragraph F, rider 2. CAPS HR is paragraph H in rider 2. And capital land acquisition, we're currently providing information to the Legislative Budget Board, and we provided to them, here's how we plan to spend the $8 million from the lifetime license endowment. $4 million is reflected in transportation items on this slide to replace the boats for law enforcement. And $3.5 million is up there on the first line for capital construction. It's like a quasi-UB to finish out some projects. And this $500,000 is for some necessary easements on Cattle Lake. This next slide, I'll probably do away with it. It's more of an informational thing. In the past, we had license plate revenues that was deposited in the capital conservation account. A trust account was created, account 0802, about 4 years ago. There was some mechanics with the comptroller's office where all the monies weren't transferred. They've all been since transferred now. So going into the next biennium, all the license plate revenues will be in account 0802. We have a Parks and Wildlife Code provision that required commission approval for projects that use capital conservation account. Now all of the monies that we have in account 5004 are in our appropriation bill pattern from sporting goods sales tax into this account for capital construction. We already have processes in place for commission approval of all of our capital construction projects. So this slide will probably go away in the future, and there's probably no need to present it. But I want y'all to be aware. So next year, if you ask me what happened to that slide, we don't have any projects that need approval. The license plate revenues are now handled in a trust account. Budget and investment policies. The first one, the budget policy, is your exhibit C, which is pages 15 and 16. There really been no material changes to this policy since 2012. Very high level is the last line on there. The commission permits the use of these funds for anything that's permitted by statute or rule. We do authorize, the commission authorizes the Parks and Wildlife Executive Director to execute the budget. If there are adjustments that are not related to federal funds or bonds greater than $250,000, it requires chair or vice chair approval. And y'all are all aware with the donations process. Anything over $500 is acknowledged and received by the chair or vice chair or designee. And at each commission meeting, those are recognized formally in the meeting. This is another housekeeping item. It's Exhibit D in your book, pages 17 through 19. Again, there have been no major changes since 2012. This slide merely provides a summary of the enabling statute for the Public Funds Investment Act and the basis for having an agency-specific investment policy. All of our monies are maintained in the Treasury, so we really don't have to have a designee investment officer. In the event that some monies were deposited outside the Treasury, the Executive Director would then have to appoint an investment officer, and that investment officer would have to ensure the agency's compliance with the Public Fund Investment Act. There's also a new provision in Article 9, not just for Parks and Wildlife, but for all agencies. There's some reporting requirements for funds held outside the Treasury. So we may have some reports that we have to report now on some of the BP monies that benefit some of the projects sent into our mission. Those are monies outside the Treasury, and so we'll participate in that reporting process. Next housekeeping item is pages 21 through 24 in your workbook. This basically ties to the performance measure for strategy B11. It's an output measure of the number of state parks in operation. And in order to keep the numbers clean, every other year we get the commission to approve a starting point list in the event that there are acquisitions or something gets sold, so that we can have clean data for the Legislative Budget Board. Before I talk you through this slide, I want to give you some history on it, and probably in November we'll probably have a more fleshed out presentation for you. I just want to back you up about 4 years ago when the legislature had some targeted pay increases to the department. It had significant cost expenditure increases for Fund 9, more so than for Account 64. So essentially, we increased our expenses by approximately $6.4 million per year over the past 4 years without a fee increase to our Fund 9 funding streams. So what was happening, we were spending down our balances for General Fund 9. We had some healthy balances for like the freshwater stamp and the migratory stamp, but we can't use those funding streams for unrestricted general type purposes. So we were noting a trend, a downward trend, spending down those balances. So that required us to take some action so that we wouldn't go zero, get to zero. One of the things that we did as an agency that we had your approval when we submitted the LAR, we did some method of finance swaps. We consolidated our general revenue in the law enforcement department in the aquatic invasives program. And that swap right there, the legislature adopted it and accepted it. That eased the burden on Fund 9 by a little over $8 million a year. So that improved the cash balances through 2019 by a positive $16 million swing. Then we looked at some other actions, statutory changes that could be looked at. One was Senate Bill 573. It expands the permissible use of freshwater stamp. That gave us some flexibility. House Bill 3781 that we've talked about, expanding the use of the lifetime license endowment. We have now $8 million that we can hit some key priority items for the department. And we had this House bill, this particular slide here, 448. I think many of you are aware that the boat revenue that we collect, the Parks and Wildlife Code, the first line on this slide, we transfer on a monthly basis 15% of all the boat revenues from Fund 9 into the state parks account, account 64. This was needed probably a dozen or more years ago when the balances for the state parks account were approaching a lower threshold. They're pretty healthy right now. House Bill 448 modified this statutory provision. It gives us flexibility and makes that permissive. The department may transfer an amount up to 15% on a monthly basis. So basically the purpose of this bill is to give us flexibility in managing our cash balances for Fund 9 and for Fund 64. Presently, the Fund 64 projections are pretty solid. They probably don't need this $3 million transfer long term. So if we're able to retain all the boat revenues in Account 9 for this biennium, that would be a $6 million positive swing for the Game Fish and Water Safety account. So tomorrow, when we have the final motion, I'm going to add that as the last item to seek your authorization and permission for the department to retain 100% of the boat fee revenues in Fund 9 for fiscal year 2018. And just for your information, if we continued the 15% transfer, the state parks ending balance in 2019 would be $40 million, and we don't have appropriation authority for that. If we keep that in Fund 9, their ending balance will be $34 million. As opposed to Fund 9, if we continue the transfer, we'll have a little over $2.5 million of unrestricted cash balances for Fund 9. If we preserve and keep that $6 million, it'll be about $8.6 million. And so we're sort of catching up because our funding stream for Fund 9 does grow between 2.5% to about 2.8%. It couldn't handle that 6.4 million cost increase, but over a period of 6 or 7 years, we're going to reach the point where we can sustain where we're at. However, if we want to do additional things when we do our next LAR, we'll have to look at how we can accomplish that with the funding stream that we have. I think when we get to the next LAR, we'll be able to sustain what we have, but we'll again be trying to figure out what can we do to grow and meet those needs that we've not been able to meet in the past. That's all I have for today. Tomorrow we'll conclude with this recommended motion, and you can see basically it's to approve all the exhibits, to approve the budget investment policy, the number of state parks, and the last item here to seek an authorization to retain all the boat revenue in Fund 9 for fiscal year 2018. I'd be happy to entertain any questions.
Sure, Douglas.
Mike, you've mentioned twice that we've been given authorization to access $8 million in the lifetime license account,
yes,
right?
That's correct.
But how much remains in that account that we do not have the ability to spend?
The bill that was passed requires us to keep a minimum balance of $20 million in there. So we're going to have we were projecting close to about $29, $30 million. So they're giving us $8 million, so we'll have $20 to $22 million still in there. This just allows us to attach the corpus to make sure we don't spend it all down. And we're still working with the Legislative Budget Board on this. We do have authority. It was a last-minute bill. So the way they passed the bill, there was language to put it in a specific goal. And I think the intent is more broader than how they passed the bill. So we're still working through that. Our intention to them is $4 million is intended for to replace boats. There are a lot of boats that were damaged along the border the last 4 or 5 years. $3.5 million for capital construction to finish out since we don't have the UBE for Fund 9. And the other $500,000 for Cattle Lake. If for some reason they say you can't have the land acquisition for Cattle Lake, then we would put that as with the other capital construction to increase the UB.
Isn't this the first time in a long time that we've been able to access the...
This is the first time ever the enabling statute only allowed us to spend down the interest. So we have a small amount of interest that has been funding some wildlife efforts.
That's my point. So I think next cycle we ought to keep in mind trying to access more of those funds. I mean, it just makes no sense that we're incurring costs associated with those licenses and not able to... The interest is totally insignificant.
We can do that. One of the things, the growth of that fund is approximately $1 million to $1.3 million a year. So we definitely should seek appropriation authority for the revenue stream. But that'd be a call for the commission if you wanted to work with the legislature. Right now, you have to have a floor of $20 million. We have to keep at least $20 million in the account.
Well, I'm suggesting we work with the Legislative Budget Board next cycle to try to reduce that floor.
No, we'll do that.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Mike? Mike, thank you.
Thanks.
All right, I'll place the financial overview on the Thursday Commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. Next, item 3, fiscal year 2017 internal audit update and proposed fiscal 2018 internal audit plan. Cindy Hancock, good morning.
Good morning. I'm Cindy Hancock, Director of Internal Audit. And I'm here today to update you on the completion status of our current internal audit plan and any external audits. And I'm also going to brief you on the proposed fiscal year 18 audit plan. Here's a list of audit projects that are in progress right now. For the State Park fiscal control audits, we've completed and issued 31 of 32 scheduled reports, with Balmoray being the last state park to be finished. The follow-up audit is ongoing, and from May through July, we followed up on the implementation status of 16 recommendations, with 6 having been implemented and 10 not. This leaves 12 internal and 4 external audit recommendations remaining in progress as of the end of July. The IT audit, which we selected the license system to audit this year, is still in progress, but fieldwork is winding down. The federal grant audit is in progress, and fieldwork will be completed very soon. Here's a list of the compliant state parks. 27 of the 31 state parks had no significant findings, and that's 87% of what we audited. Only 4 state parks had findings, and all have been taken care of and resolved during the follow-up process. 11 of the 12 law enforcement offices had no findings. That's 92%. And the one office that did have a finding, the issue has been resolved. So our fiscal year 17 internal audit plan looks like this today. 2 projects are still in field work stage, but they're very close to be finished. 2 are in the final reporting stage, and 4 have been completed. So we're in pretty good shape as we end the fiscal year. For external audits, the Department of Interior Office of the Inspector General conducted a U.S. Fish and Wildlife federal grant audit, and management has provided responses to the draft report. At this time, we are waiting to hear back from the auditors on this one. I know I've been reporting on this for a long time. I'll be glad when this one's closed. The KPMG audit firm has been hired by Microsoft and to conduct a Microsoft Office licensing audit. The results we're hoping will be reported sometime, and this audit will be finished in September. Also, the State Auditor's Office is in the fieldwork stage of the Infrastructure Division's contracting processes. Their report, they have advised us, is scheduled to be issued in October. For completed external audits, we have some good news. The Texas Workforce Commission has conducted an EEO and Human Resource Policy Compliance Audit, of which TPWD passed with no issues. And finally, our internal audit department went through a peer review process and were found to be compliant with the standards and code of ethics. We received a pass rating. So before I move on to the proposed fiscal year 18 audit plan, do you have any questions?
Vice Chairman Duggan.
Am I right that the only uncompleted audit being conducted by any federal agency is this one you referenced for the Department of Interior?
That's correct. As far as I know, that's correct.
Thank you.
I would just like to comment on the audit. I guess success on all of the state parks and the law enforcement agencies. I know you guys have been getting emails from me every time we get a report on one to try to highlight the excellence that we find, but it can't be overstated. I know we're all kind of sleepy this morning and we're just kind of brushing over this stuff, but that's real important stuff, that these agencies, these divisions are operating very efficiently and are spending the state funds. I mean, we just had the finance report and about the challenges that we have. But the one thing that we can all rest assured on is that the money that we do get is being spent appropriately. And that's really outstanding kudos to the staff and to the division leaders and the regional commanders and folks who emphasize what's important to this commission. And I just want to really thank Brent and Colonel for all of your help and your support to make this happen.
I don't know if I'm a normal auditor, but it's always a wonderful experience to have an audit completed with no findings. Okay, the Texas Internal Audit Act requires that audit plan should be developed using a risk-based approach consisting of executive management's review of agencies' functions, activities, and processes. The risk should be ranked on the probability of occurrence and impact to the agency in the financial, managerial, compliance, and information technology areas. Questionnaires or surveys were sent to executive management and division directors. The surveys were structured to obtain top concerns within the division, agency-wide, external to the agency, as well as concerns regarding information technology systems and fraud, waste, and abuse. Responses were recorded, and these concerns were scored and ranked, creating a list of priority concerns. Once the responses were scored, I sent the top concerns to executive management and Commissioner Jones to score as to their priority. Once prioritized and categorized, I estimated the work hours needed to complete each project and compared it to the total number of auditable work hours available to our audit team. I then sent the proposed internal audit plan to our executive director and Commissioner Jones for comment. The plan will be finalized upon commission approval, hopefully tomorrow. Exhibit A shows our new proposed projects for fiscal year 18. This exhibit also includes the number of hours estimated to complete these projects. Also included in the fiscal year 18 internal audit plan is an alternative project that can be substituted or added if time permits. We have good project coverage in most divisions this year, and it will be a busy one for all involved. Therefore, this is the motion that I'll be asking you to adopt tomorrow, approval of the fiscal year 18 internal audit plan. This concludes my presentation, and I'll be glad to answer any
great
questions.
Work. Thank you, Cindy. Any questions, Cindy?
Thanks so much.
Okay, I'll place this, the fiscal year 2018 internal audit plan on the Thursday commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. Item 4, nonprofit partner rules, request permission to publish proposed changes in the Texas Register. Mr. Kevin Good.
Good morning, Commissioners.
Good morning.
My name is Kevin Good. I'm with State Parks Division. This morning I'm going to bring a proposal for some changes to the nonprofit organization rules of the agency. The existing nonprofit partner rules were originally established back in 2001 following an agency sunset review. At that time, the concept of nonprofit partners and the Parks and Wildlife Foundation were relatively new, so the sunset review recommended the commission implement some rules governing these types of nonprofit partners. There's three broad categories in this section of our rules. It first defines the types of agency nonprofit partners. It establishes best practices and establishes some department procedures for working with these nonprofits. As currently written, there are three types of nonprofit partner categories. First is the official nonprofit partner that's approved by the commission, and of course that is the Parks and Wildlife Foundation, Annie and her folks. Closely related nonprofits, these are Friends Groups for State Parks or the Freshwater Fisheries Center's Friends Group. These are groups that were established primarily to provide support to a particular department site or program. And then finally, there are general nonprofit partners, and we'll talk a little bit more about those. The current rules also require Parks and Wildlife to maintain a list of all of these partners. So what is a general nonprofit partner? Well, the definition in the code refers to a nonprofit partner that is neither a closely related nonprofit partner nor the official nonprofit partner. You're probably kind of scratching your head after reading that. Further on, there are some additional guidance provided to the agency in developing the rules. It states that a general nonprofit partner would be a group that has an agreement of any kind with the department, has a representative serving on the department or commission advisory committee, or otherwise has a relationship with Texas Parks and Wildlife. Still, those are pretty broad, and as you can imagine, sometimes developing this is a little bit arbitrary. So in the proposed rule changes, we're asking to make a few minor changes, really. The staff would like to remove references to the general nonprofit partners. The designations for the official nonprofit partner and the closely related nonprofit partners would remain, as well as the requirement that those groups follow the best practices that are established. Those requirements do not extend to the general nonprofit partners because, again, those groups can be anything from a Boy Scout troop that maybe performs a weekend work project at a park to somebody like the Desert Bighorn Society, which we have an ongoing and regular relationship with. We also feel that this action would greatly simplify the administrative code and that it would allow us to focus on those groups that we do truly have an ongoing relationship with rather than spending our time developing a list of hundreds of groups that may come in for just a day or so and do some type of project. I'd also like to point out that near as we can determine, nobody has ever asked for this list of general nonprofit partners. And if somebody is interested in the contributions of those groups, the majority of that would be covered in the list of donations that y'all approve at each meeting. So at this time, staff requests permission to publish proposed amendments to Chapter 31, Texas Administrative Code, Chapter 51, Subchapter G, in the Texas Register for public comment. And I'll be happy to address any questions you may have.
Any questions for Kevin? Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, staff, I'll authorize staff to publish the proposed nonprofit partner rules in the Texas Register for the required public comment period. Item 5 is 2017-18 OYSTER rules, recommended adoption of proposed changes. Morning, Lance.
Good morning. Good morning, Commissioners. Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Lance Robinson with Coastal Fisheries Division, and I'm here this morning to kind of bring you up to speed on a proposal that we brought before you in May and for final action tomorrow. dealing with the commercial oyster fishery. As you may recall, in May, I gave a brief on some of the issues that this industry and this fishery is and resource has undergone in the last decade. Beginning in 2008, Hurricane Ike came across, made landfall in Galveston Bay. The resource, the predominant abundance of oysters are found in that system. We lost about half of those from that storm. 2010, Deepwater Horizon created some situations where other states were closed, increasing harvest pressure on the resources here in Texas. 2011 through 15, we had one of our drought of records, and although that's typically harmless, the high salinities are harmless to the oysters, there are some parasites and diseases that increase during those high salinity events, and we certainly saw mortality associated with those over that four-year time frame. And then most recently in 2015 and 2016, the flooding events that occurred hit at a time when oysters are typically spawning. So we basically lost a couple of year classes of that resource in the Galveston system and some other resources, spawners and adults and some of the recruits in some other base systems along the coast. So all of those events kind of coming together, any one by themselves, probably would not have been a major blow to that resource, but the cumulative impacts of those coupled with a high harvest pressure that we are seeing in this fishery, partly brought on by the fact that other Gulf states are also having some challenges with oyster production in their states, and so the demand for oysters is very high. This slide just kind of gives you a picture, a snapshot of how that value of the oyster keeps continuing to go up while the landings are dropping a bit. And I will point out that in 2013, that precipitous-looking drop that you see on the slide is somewhat department-driven. That was when we started implementing the emergency closures, where we would step in and close base systems when we found that market abundance of oysters were depleted. So we would step in and close those, so obviously the landings, those areas closed, so the landings would drop during that time. When we do open those areas that have been closed, typically have been closed for 2 years, or we do restoration activities and they're closed for 2 years prior to opening, the fleet is very mobile, and these are the kind of episodes that we see. We get a large fleet of boats that move into the area, work very hard on there, and very quickly they've depleted that resource. Again, part of that high harvest pressure that we're seeing up and down the coast. And the fleet will move up and down the coast depending on where the availability of oysters are. One other thing that we also observed of late, and it's partly driven by the fact that we're closing big bay areas or deep water reefs because of management implications and loss of abundance of the market ones, is the fleet is beginning to move around into other areas, areas that we historically have not seen a lot of activity in. It's shallow water reefs, intertidal reefs up near the shoreline, also some smaller bay systems along the coast that traditionally, although some harvest has taken place, we've not really seen the magnitude of the harvest that we've seen over the last few years. Just to kind of bring you to where we are right now, the current these are a list of the current regulations that apply to the oyster fishery, 40 sacks a day. They can legally fish from sunrise to 3:30 in the afternoon. Legal fishing days currently are Monday through Saturday. Sunday is closed to commercial harvest, and there is a 3-inch minimum size on oysters. The last bullet there is a requirement that a cargo of oysters, or however many oysters are on the boat, sacks, they cannot be made up of more than 15% that are undersized or also contain dead shell in the sack. And so one of the things I wanted, let me go back to this one. So one of the things that we did after up to this point, we've had a number of public comments that have come in. We've also heard from the industry. One of the things that we've done is gone back and kind of revisit and look at the data that we compiled to come up with the original proposals. And based on the comments and that we're hearing, we're here today to kind of bring you a modified proposal for consideration for tomorrow. And I'll kind of jump into that real quick. So this was the proposal we brought before you in May. The area highlighted in yellow would be the modification to this original proposal. So we're proposing that the sack limit reduction go from 40 sacks to 30 sacks per day. and the elimination of Saturday instead of Monday as a legal fishing day. And I'll get into that in just a minute. Going from 40 to 30 sacks and the closure of Saturday in the fishery, we don't believe it's going to have an overall impact on the total number of sacks harvested in a given year. And the reason we say that is because when we looked at the analysis of what's currently being harvested by this industry, they're not utilizing the full opportunities that's available to them. For example, they're fishing under a 40 sack limit now, but for the last 3 years they've been averaging about 25 sacks a day. The number of days that are allowed in a season are about 150 days or so, 156 days in a season, but they're on average only fishing about 106 days over the course of the whole year, an average vessel. So we don't expect that any of these particular two changes would have an impact on the overall harvest. What we do believe will happen, we really have two fisheries that are taking place here in Texas. We have a half-shell fishery where dealers are harvesting product that they sell to restaurants for that half-shell trade. We also have a market or an industry that is looking for shucking oysters, oysters that they can remove from the shell and they package in pints or quart containers and they sell to restaurants and to grocery stores and things like that. The challenge is that the half shell market can fish pretty much any time on the resource and utilize that product in their markets. And they typically shoot for November and December as the time that's most optimum for that half shell market. However, the shucking market, they want an oyster that weighs a lot more. And the oyster doesn't really start putting on weight until the winter months when it starts bulking up with fat stores, getting ready for spawning. So the optimum time for harvesting oysters that would be shucked are going to be January and February, those colder months. The water is colder. So the idea here with this particular proposal would be to delay some of that harvest that's taking place now in November and December and push some of it back into January and February by not allowing as much of the product to be taken out of the water earlier in the season and instead taking it out when that that shucking product is more available and usable to that industry. The other option that proposal that we had was a reduction in that tolerance for undersized oysters in a cargo from 15% down to 5%. Now, I've added a slide in here. We had this slide in the May meeting. It's probably not in order in your presentation, but it is attached at the end of your presentation on your computers. This particular slide shows the number of cases filed by law enforcement over the last 6 years for undersized oysters, for that 15% undersized. And one of the things I'll draw your attention to is the bottom row there, and especially 2014, and that number of 223 cases that were filed for violation of undersized oysters. The following year, it went down, and if you recall back to that slide when I showed the difference in the price per pound and the landings, that was about the time we started implementing the closures in these areas. When the market oysters became depleted, we would step in and close the area down, and it certainly had a positive effect on the number of undersized cases that were coming in. But that number has begun to creep back up. In the more recent years, we're up to 127. And you can't see this from the screen. I apologize. You can probably see it better in your presentation there. But draw your attention to the bullets to the side. This was a case, an event that took place in February of 2017 in the central part of the coast, San Antonio Bay, Aransas Bay, in that area. And this is 37 cases. All were undersized oyster cases. But 68% of these cases contained cargoes in excess of 30% undersized. And you'll see, certainly up near the top of the list, we had some cases that as many as 95% of the cargo was all undersized product. In bay systems up and down the coast, it varies on what a legal number of oysters in a sack would be, ranges from 260 to 300. Some of those cases you'll see there had abundance of oysters in a sack of over 1,200 oysters in an individual sack. Currently, this violation is a Class C. It applies only to the captain. House Bill 51 that passed this session expands and enhances this particular penalty. It now would apply to the captain and the crew members. And as the penalty violations, number of violations increase, then that penalty will escalate to a Class B and also includes a license suspension, both for the captain, the crew, and for the vessel. Another part of our proposal that we are bringing before you is the closure of some minor bay systems, seven originally proposed. We bring to you a modification of that by removing Keller Bay, which is just off of Port Lavaca or Lavaca Bay, as part of that closure option. And then to close areas of shoreline that are within 300 feet of that shoreline, primarily to protect these intertidal oyster reefs that occur in those shallow waters. This is just a list, kind of the distribution geographically of where these minor bays are located along the Texas coast. And just a little bit on the intertidal oysters, some of the information that's now becoming available and is available in the literature, scientific literature, is that the value of these intertidal reefs are being found to be much higher than what was previously thought, even to the comparison of the deeper water reefs. Some of the ecosystem services that these oyster reefs provide outside of the commercial value and even the recreational fishing value approach values up as high as $240,000 an acre. And certainly these are very important for other species abundance and recruitment. This slide just gives you an idea of the total number of acres that would be covered by this proposed closure of these minor bays. For this slide, I've taken out the Keller Bay, and so the yellow number down at the bottom in parentheses represents the total number of acres of oyster habitat that would be protected from these harvest from these closures. The column to the right, the first number is the percentage of oyster reef within the bay system that minor bay is affiliated with. So, for example, Christmas Bay is part of the Galveston Bay complex. So 2.5%, Christmas Bay accounts for 2.5% of the oyster habitat in Galveston Bay, or the parentheses 1.4% of the total acreage of Texas, total oyster acreage. For the intertidal oyster reefs, again, we propose a closure within 300 feet of the shoreline. And we looked at three different options here, settling on the 300-foot buffer. This just gives you a breakdown of the total number of acres that would be affected by this particular closure. And again, down at the bottom, and when you add the minor bay closure acreage as well as the bottom 300-foot buffer zone, you're looking at a total of about 2,860 acres, but it would be closed or about 6% of the total oyster habitat in the state of Texas. As of public comments that we received thus far, as of last night, this slide is a little bit dated, and I'll update it for tomorrow. But as of 5 o'clock yesterday, that we've had a total of 1,457 comments. About 81% were expressed explicit agreement with the proposals that originally proposed. About 18% were explicit in their comments in disagreeing with the proposal. About 1% no opinion. And you'll see that the support that the groups that have identified their support for this proposal is also, we've had some additional groups come in, Lower Brazos River Watch, the National Wildlife Federation, and the Bayou City Waterkeepers have also submitted comments in support of these proposals. Of those comments that were in opposition, we have 87 of the 197 comments were opposed, but they were in support of an industry proposal. That industry proposal very briefly asked that the department not lower the sack limit, to maintain it at 40 sacks, or in fact increase the sack limit to 50, but allow the department flexibility to modify sack limits In season. So during the season, based on sampling, if we found that the sac limit needed to be lowered in an area, then act on that and close it. That's a challenge that makes it difficult for enforcement, but also from the standpoint of monitoring every base system in every area with sampling that's robust enough to be able to determine when that sac limit should be changed. The other option that the industry proposed was no additional day closure. Felt like the 6 days was adequate, and they preferred to not have that day closure. In talking with some individuals, we have had some comments from some folks in the industry who have asked that if we're going to do a closure, they would prefer Saturday to be the closure as opposed to the originally proposed Monday. Because they voiced some concerns over getting trucking companies lined up on a weekend versus a weekday. It's easier on a weekday, obviously. And the other point that they have actually made as well is by closing on a Saturday with the already Sunday closure, that would also remove the commercial fishery from interactions with the public recreational fishery. Kind of takes that out of that conflict that may occur. The other comments that we've received, we have had some concerns voiced through these public comments about the impacts of these closures of these minor bays and the 300-foot buffer to recreational fishermen, and specifically recreational fishermen who would like to go out and harvest oysters during the day. Recreationally, a fisherman is allowed to keep up to two sacks. A sack is 110 pounds. They're allowed to keep up to two sacks per person per day. We do intercept fishermen in our creel surveys that sometimes will harvest oysters. It's a very small number of individuals. In 2016, I believe, we had in 2016, recreational harvest looked like it was about 704 hours in the year that was expended harvesting oysters recreationally, harvesting a total of 10.6 sacks during the year. And then the other comments that we heard that were really in opposition to the proposals, they were really specifying that they thought there should be more restrictions, either close the season, the fishery down for several years, go into togging only, get rid of the dredges. So several options were presented that were more restricted than what was originally proposed. So with that, I think that's my presentation. I'd be happy to try to answer any questions for you. And
Commissioner Moria.
Thanks, sir.
Clarification, the pounds and price per pound, that's in the shell, that's...
That price per pound is not, that's the meat price.
That's the meat price.
Yes, sir.
And each bag weighs 110 pounds?
110 pounds, each bag will have about 19 pounds of meat.
Pounds of meat. And you may not know the answer to this, but somebody has a 95%, a bag 95% or undersized oysters. How do those move into the commerce stream? I mean, if you got a bag of 2-inch oysters, what do you do with them?
Yeah. Good question. In talking with industry, and I have to relay, this is information that industry has shared in our conversations under the Oyster Advisory Work Group. Some of those undersized oysters are being sold as half shell product. There are some states that are buying that product, and I think that's helping to drive that market. And so they're able to sell some of that just for the half shell, just a smaller oyster on the plate. Some of them are actually being shucked, even though it's a little harder to shuck a smaller oyster. So they're figuring out ways to get it into the market, but it's just a smaller product than what would normally be expected and certainly would be legal.
And your landings in pounds, that's the meat pounds. So there was 7 million pounds. I mean, there was 3 million pounds roughly in 2016. Is that
correct?
Of
yes.
Meat.
That's correct.
Okay. Thanks. Thank you.
Commissioner Duggins.
Lance, where in the rules is a sack defined to be 110 pounds?
The sack definition is actually in statute.
Okay.
It defines it as a volume, a box that is defined by 20 inches by 13 by whatever. And several years ago, I believe, and Brandy may be able to speak more to this, but I believe law enforcement constructed boxes. There were some problems that were coming up where sacks were coming in heavier than what they were loading them heavy. And so there was a calculation done. They built some boxes, filled them up, weighed them, and came up with this 110-pound that now is in our proclamation.
But our rules are tied to the statutory definition of sack?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Second question is, in 5822D1, we say 20, that's where we're proposing to go to 25, now 30 sacks of culled oysters of legal size. What is meant by culled?
Culled oyster, a culled oyster would be an oyster that doesn't have dead shell. It's that 15% is if it's got 15% undersize and dead shell, and that's it or less, then that's considered a culled load. The tolerance going to 5% would have them cleaning that product up better. There'd be fewer pieces of shell. There'd be fewer smaller oysters in the sack. But that culled is actually going through, and they dump a load of oysters on the deck. They're going through measuring, supposed to be measuring, knocking off the undersized oysters and only keeping the legal oysters. That's culling the catch.
You're culling out the undersized oysters?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks. Any other questions from that? Commissioner Johnson.
Why was Keller Bay first included and then excluded?
Sure. Yeah, good question. Thank you. I'm sorry I meant to speak to that. When we first went down the road looking at, I mean, Christmas Bay was the one that really got the attention and really started us looking at these smaller secondary, tertiary bays. And as we started looking at Christmas Bay, we decided to let's look at other similar bay systems along the coast. And so that's where the seven originally came from. As we started looking more closely at the dynamics of these systems and the reason for Keller, all the other bay systems are actually part of the State Health Department classifies areas as approved waters. All the other bay systems except Keller have their own unique designation. Okay, Keller is a small sub-bay off of Lavaca Bay. And when we started looking at Keller and that Lavaca Bay and the landings as well as the availability of resource, Keller is really driven by what's going on in Lavaca Bay. There's very few oysters in Keller Bay. It's a deeper bay. It's physically different than the other bay systems. The others are much more shallow. They have oyster reefs and seagrass and some other valuable ecosystem habitat associated with them. Keller Bay is just a little bit different, and so of any of the ones that might be a candidate for removal, Keller was the one we felt like really didn't fit the mold as well as the other six. And so that's why that one kind of separated out.
Okay, so I'm just a little confused as to why it was in there then in the first place. So.
When we first took our look at it, we kind of looked at it more broadly and kind of looked at the oyster reefs in there. Based on the comments we were hearing and kind of going back and then revisiting and diving down into the data that we have, we begin to see that Keller is just a little bit different than the other ones. And originally, if we dove a little deeper, we probably would not have had that as one of the original ones. So that was kind of the reason it kind of teased out.
Powderhorn, the reason Powderhorn has NA is because that really wasn't a legal place to harvest.
No, it was legal to harvest. Powderhorn has been legally available for harvest for many years, but it is a very shallow bay. It's really a lot of intertidal oyster habitat, and so that certainly has a very high value from the ecosystem standpoint and the protection of those intertidal oyster reefs that we're trying to accomplish.
So why does it have NA instead of
assignment of
acreage
and
value.
I'm sorry. Yeah. Part of the challenge there is as we do our monitoring, Powderhorn has not been a base system that we've routinely gone in and sampled ourselves. because it's so shallow, the gear that we use is an oyster dredge, and we can't sample in that bay system because of its shallow nature. And so we're looking now at ways to new techniques that would allow us to get in and quantify habitat using other types of gear, other than the dredge, maybe a tong, patent tong or something like that. We'll also be doing some side scan work in there, but we physically haven't been able to get in and sample it because of its shallow nature.
But it does have acres of oyster habitat.
Absolutely.
We just don't know exactly.
Absolutely, yes, sir.
Okay. All right.
One more, Dan. So, Lance, you're saying that as to Keller Bay, the science is such that you're not concerned about it in the same vein as the other six?
That's correct, yes.
All right, thank you.
Any other questions for Lance? Yep. Commissioner Scott.
I would suggest tomorrow, when you're giving your presentation, what jumps out at me, and having been from that area, the percentage of undersize and the actually it's huge. I did not realize it had gotten that much out of line, but I think that's something that needs to be very clearly pointed out very early on.
Okay.
Because a whole lot of the reason we're looking at addressing what we're addressing is because of this over-harvesting and taking the smaller ones out. Because that's creating the issue on top of the natural disasters.
Thank you. I'll do that.
You might switch your slide presentation. You might switch this undersized stuff. Put it in the front,
okay,
and then put your other presentation behind it.
Thank you. I will.
Questions? Lance, thank you. Appreciate
thank you.
All your hard work. I'll place 2017-18 oyster rules on the Thursday Commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. Item 6 is Coastal Management Area Classification and Conduct Rules. Request permission to publish proposed changes in the Texas Register for Public Notice and Comment. Robin Rikers, morning.
Good morning, Chairman and Commissioners. For the record, I'm Robin Rikers with Coastal Fisheries Division. And starting about a year ago, Land Conservation started bringing you several different tracts of acquisitions that you've either approved to acquire, and we're in some form of acquiring those properties now in both Matagorda and Brazoria counties. There we go. All of those tracts have high fish and game values and are ideally situated for unimproved recreational use, including hunting, fishing, kayaking, beach use, and birding, among others. And Ted Hollingsworth certainly went into more detail about some of the activities on those properties. Those lands are acquired with various agreements on them based on the funding sources, whether those be from Deepwater Horizon funding sources or partnership philanthropy that has helped us acquire some of those tracts and bring those into the system. Many of these tracts have long since been looked at in the conservation community, trying to figure out how to put them into conservation, and so we're seeing the fruition of some of that now. What we really didn't have, though, was a classification system for these tracts of land, and so what we're proposing to do with this item is basically create a classification system, which is allowed under Parks and Wildlife Code. The commission can create a different classification systems for wildlife management areas, and in this term, it's not wildlife management areas as you think of in Clayton Shop, but it's the term of how we classify those lands. And so what we're bringing before you is an item that will actually create that classification. We will call them coastal management areas, if you agree. And then the item will go on to basically delineate some of the public use rules of conduct. Moving forward, these CMAs will be monitored and managed by Coastal Fisheries Division, of course, with help from our sister divisions, law enforcement, wildlife, et cetera. But the whole goal here is to both manage them in alignment with the agreements that were reached to bring those into conservation, but also for the enjoyment of the public and Texans as they enjoy them today. So basically, in a general sense, what we're going to propose is either, and it may be prohibition of certain activities or regulation of certain activities, But in general sense, some of the things that we would be concerned with on these types of properties is abandonment of property of any sort. So we're going to basically prohibit that sort of thing. Obviously, in our state parks and in our other lands that we manage, consumption of alcoholic beverages. The issues regarding discharge of firearms so that we can ensure safety when people are on the property. And of course, we would also, if we can, try to also find ways to create hunting opportunity. Obviously, some of these properties could have natural and cultural resources, and we want to ensure that all of those natural and cultural resources are protected in all the ways that we can afford them protection. We may want to manage, given the remote nature of some of these properties and also the facts that we won't necessarily have people on site, we may want to manage camping and campfires and the duration that someone could camp on those properties. Other activities regarding fishing and hunting, there may be some things there that we need to do as well. But what our plan is try to find some ways to allow some level of waterfowl hunting at the very least here. And through the use of the annual public hunt permit, we believe we can do that in accordance to how we manage our other lands that we would be allowing people to hunt on. And then lastly, obviously, when you think about vehicle use on these properties, these are barrier island properties, some of them. And so, you know, our goal will be to manage that in a way and at least try to direct people to certain traffic paths as opposed to just letting them go anywhere on the properties. And we hope to do that with both some probably regulated activities, but also through signage and through some development of paths where we basically guide people through those properties if they're going to be on them. So our goal here is to come before you with a permission to publish the proposed amendments in the Texas Register, and we'd come back to you in November for adoption. And just to remind you of those properties that we're talking about, it's really the Follett's Island Initiative, which is in total, we hope to acquire somewhere in the neighborhood of 1,200 to 1,400 acres eventually there. We have about 850 in acquisition now or in some level of acquisition. The Sartwell property, which is up the road from our Perry R. Bass Research Station, about 450 acres, and that, you know, part of that will also be able to be used in some sort of conservation activity, and then, of course, the Matagorda Peninsula as well. So those are the three properties in question that we're talking about now, and, of course, those could be added to as we move forward in the next few years to come. With that, I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Questions from Commissioner Johnson?
Don't we have properties that have a mixed use like this? It's about the conservation and we allow hunting and certain activities?
Yes, Commissioner Jones. Certainly we have WMAs that have some of those kinds of properties and activities as well as some of our state parks also. And so what we've done is we've kind of looked at that list. The only difference here is that these are going to be unmanned on site, and so they're going to be a little bit different in nature, but we're certainly using some of those rules that we have in those other places as a guide here.
So you're not completely having to reinvent the wheel on these rules that you're proposing?
That is absolutely correct. Okay. Yes.
Any other questions for Robin? Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, I'll authorize staff to publish the proposed coastal management area rules in the Texas Register for the required public notice and comment period. Item 7 is a briefing on chronic wasting disease. Science update, Dr. Bob Dittmar. Good morning.
Good morning, Commissioner, Mr. Chairman, Director Smith. My name is Bob Dittmar. I'm the veterinarian with Texas Parks and Wildlife. I've been tasked this morning with providing an update on information regarding CWD research. CWD has only been identified for about 50 years, so it's a relatively new disease, particularly when we compare it to other transmissible spongiform encephalopathies that we know about, like scrapie. While there's been a lot of progress in CWD research, there's still a lot we have to learn. This will be a very high-altitude flyover of some new work, some older ongoing work that I thought you might find interesting. The first study I'm going to cover is from a report given by Dr. Stephanie Shube at the recent 2017 Prion conference held in Edinburgh, Scotland. It's stated in the title, this is a preliminary report on a work in progress that started in 2009. It's not complete, it hasn't been peer-reviewed, nor has it been published. Basically, the study used 21 Salmonella macaques that were exposed to CWD by various means that might be similar to human exposure. I want to stress up front that macaques are animal models that can be used to study human disease. They're not little humans. And though they're genetically similar to humans, this does not mean the study equates to human infection. We have several cervid species that are not known to be naturally infected with CWD. First off, I've listed intracranial challenge as a proof of concept. Intracranial challenge is not an expected human exposure, but it's used to show that macaques can be infected. Basically, it's a positive control. In the oral challenges, which would mimic humans eating or consuming deer meat, some of those macaques received 5 doses of 2 grams of positive brain material over 15 months. Others received 200 grams, or about 7 ounces, of muscle tissue from positive CWD-positive white-tailed deer monthly for 2 years. This totaled about 5 kilograms, or roughly the body weight of those macaques. The muscle meat was from non-clinical CWD-positive white-tailed deer. In the skin scarification, which would mimic possible exposures when hunters are field dressing deer, positive material was applied to abraded skin, and in the blood transfusion, blood was taken from macaques that had been exposed to CWD-positive material from elk, white-tailed deer, and mule deer. While humans wouldn't get blood transfusions from macaques or deer, blood transfusions or transmitting human TSEs by blood transfusion is a topic of great interest. We have some preliminary reports so far on this. The study's not complete. So far, 11 animals have been euthanized as per schedule or for humane reasons. The report is going to center on the first 5 animals, which basically at this time, that's all the data they have is those first 5 that were euthanized. 2 were challenged by intracranial inoculation, and 3 were challenged by oral administration of CWD-positive white-tailed deer muscle or brain tissue.
What do you mean by challenged?
They're given that material, basically dosed with it, to see if they come in with it. The results so far, the post-inoculation time on those 5 animals was from 4.5 to 6.2 years. 4 of the 5 developed symptoms that were commensurate with CWD, such as wasting, ataxia, apathy, and tremor. The one that was not symptomatic was a scheduled postmortem that was an intracranial challenge. All were positive for CWD by various testing methods, and all had histopathological lesions that were consistent with CWD. Some observations from this study. In this study, the histopathological evidence was observed earlier in the spinal cord than the brain. In cervids, it's expected that the prions will travel by nerve pathways first to the brain and then the spinal cord. In this situation, it seemed to go first to the brain and then the spinal cord, suggesting a different pathway of prion progression in the macaques. This is also the same pathway that seemed to occur when macaques were experimentally exposed or infected with bovine spongiform encephalopathy. I'd also point out in the earlier study, those macaques were giving fewer larger doses of infectious material, whereas in this study they were given multiple smaller, more frequent doses. Some other observations, there was a high incidence of diabetes in this study group of macaques. It's not clear if this is significant, as the colonies used to provide the macaques have a high rate of diabetes. Genetically, they're predisposed to it. The earlier study had some diabetic animals, but not as many, and just we do know insulin has some immunoprotective properties. There are 10 animals left from the original 21. The study may terminate in the coming year, basically just due to cost factors. This study has cost almost $8 million to date. And also, with this study, the Centers for Disease Control is considering strengthening their recommendations regarding testing and consumption of harvest in CWD endemic areas. Moving on to another study. This is a study that's been recently published. This group inoculated elk, mule deer, and white-tailed deer with CWD, and they found that prions in urine and feces as early as 6 months post-inoculation, and that feces were more likely to contain prions than urine, and the more susceptible genotypes were much more likely to shed the prions in urine and feces. Another study that was presented at Prion 2017 is a compilation of previous studies and some ongoing work by Dr. Candace Matheson, who's from the Prion Research Center at Colorado State University. They've been looking at CW transmission and cervage using various materials. One of the studies used large amounts of brain material orally, and they were finding positive animals 3 to 18 months post-inoculation. That work is still ongoing using smaller amounts of material. Using saliva and giving doses of 15 to 50 cc's, which is about 1 to 3 tablespoons, they were finding positive at 12 months post-inoculation. Using smaller doses, they were finding positives at 12 months with QIC amplification testing, and that study is also ongoing using smaller amounts. By giving blood, they were finding positive at 6 months post-inoculation. Interestingly, they found if they gave only the plasma or the liquid fraction of the blood, they did not detect CWD. But if they gave the cellular fraction, they had positives in that same 6 months post-inoculation time frame. Fomites are inanimate objects that can pass disease. In this study, they transferred bedding, feed and water containers from known infected pens and exposed naive deer. And they had positive deer 15 months post-exposure. They also conducted a study where they challenged deer with oral urine and feces. They did not detect any positives after 38 months. Those animals were sacrificed. But another study took that brain material from those particular deer and were able to infect transgenic mice. These researchers also demonstrated vertical transmission or mother-to-fetus transmission in muntjac deer, and also found positive fetal tissue, uterine tissue, placentomes, and amniotic fluid in positive free-ranging elk. Here are a couple of studies dealing with population declines in local populations. All these studies were on herds with a long history of CWD that had a high prevalence. The Edmonds study was in white-tailed deer in Wyoming. He estimated a 10.4% annual decline in that population and found that CWD deer were four and a half times more likely to die than non-positive deer. The DeVivo study was in mule deer, also in Wyoming. Her model predicted a 19% annual decline in population and found that CWD-positive deer were 3 times more likely to die than the non-positive deer. The Manello study dealt with elk, and in that study they concluded that CWD can exceed natural mate rates of mortality, reduce survival of adult females, and decrease population growth of elk herds. Some research that's anticipated or upcoming. While there have been a lot of studies on prions, transmissibility, environmental contamination, and things like that, to date there have only been about 11 studies on management and control. The first two studies listed there you may have seen some press information about. Matter of fact, there was an article in my AVMA journal this morning when I opened it about that. The hypothesis on that is that fire or grazing by non-susceptible species like wild horses could reduce the prion loads in plants out in the environment. And I'm sure that we know to what degree plant uptake plays a role in CWD transmission yet, but that will be an interesting study. The adaptive management studies are coming from Wyoming and Colorado, and they will compare different harvest strategies to reduce prevalence and evaluate population effects. And with that, I'll entertain any questions.
Any questions?
Commissioner Jones.
So I'm going to admit my ignorance. I didn't know what a macaque was, so I looked it up. That's a monkey, right?
Yeah, sure.
All right. Did the oral, I think you call it challenge, I'll call it application, did they cook the deer meat before they gave it to the monkey?
I'm not exactly sure. No, I do not. That, no, they did not. But it's pretty well generally accepted that cooking temperatures will not destroy the prions, so they don't think that was a major factor in that. In this particular study as well, those in macaques are not really meat eaters, so they were actually given the meat by tube feeding it.
Well, you jumped ahead on my next question, is whether cooking does anything to it.
Yeah. There was another study, I think, that was conducted in France where those macaques did actually eat the meat, and I believe that's still an ongoing study.
Because I would be interested in knowing, while cooking may not, does cooking and digesting cooked meat, does that make a difference?
Yeah, interesting point.
The enzymes and whatever in your stomach treats it differently.
We're relatively sure that the regular digestive enzymes probably do not inactivate prions. There's been some studies where they have looked at animals like coyotes and found that the prions do pass through their digestive system and they can find it in the feces. So while I don't know that for a fact, I would be surprised if that actually occurred.
And that would happen in non-susceptible animals as well for the grazing study, wouldn't it?
Yes, sir. That would be very true. And quite probably it occurs in susceptible species. With that study about the shedding of the prions in the feces, one of the things they pointed out was that they were keeping these animals in a research facility that it had high levels of CWD. So they're not sure that the difference in urine production and feces production maybe did not have something to do with just pass-through, that they were picking up the prions out there and actually pooping them out.
Do we know, in the other six, is that just timing of the study, waiting for the results on the other six that were euthanized? Or
on the macaque study?
Yes, on the first one.
No, I don't know a definitive time. I know this study may end. And this is kind of a multinational study. The funding and Dr. Schub are actually in Canada. The macaques are actually in Germany. And so, like I said, they've had 11 that were euthanized, but we only have the results on 5. So I would anticipate it's going to be quite a few years before we get the total study out.
And they spent $8 million to study a sample size of 11?
Did I hear that
correctly? 11 animals and $8 million study?
And again, this is the transmissible. I didn't point that out. The transmissibility portion of this is not the total study. They're doing some other things as well.
Yep.
And looking at that. So. But it's pretty expensive. That's why it is.
I was just curious. Yeah. That's all. Anything else? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Thanks.
Okay. Item number 8 is disease detection and response rules, chronic wasting disease, zone rules, movement of deer, recommended adoption of proposed changes. Morning, Mitch.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, Commissioners, Director Smith. For the record, my name is Mitch Lockwood. I'm the Big Game Program Director. And tomorrow I will recommend adoption to proposed amendments to the rules pertaining to the CWD zones in Texas, which this commission adopted last May. The proposed amendment pertains to the movement of breeder deer from deer breeding facilities that have a TC3 status and are located within a CWD zone in this state. The rules of Division 1 in Chapter 65, Subchapter B, prohibit the movement of susceptible species except as authorized in either 65.81, which pertain to the containment zone rules, or 65.82, which pertain to the surveillance zone rules, or 65.87, which address how these rules may be applicable to scientific research permits. During the May Commission meeting, this commission adopted, among other things, amendments to 65.81 and 65.82, which authorized some movement of breeder deer within CWD containment zones and surveillance zones in this state. You may recall that breeder deer may be released from a TC1 deer breeding facility to any registered release site that's located within that same containment zone. And also within the containment zone rules, breeder deer may be released from TC2 deer breeding facilities onto adjacent release sites under the same ownership within that same zone. But there's no reference to TC3 facilities in either 65.81 or 65.82. So this applies to both the containment zone and the surveillance zone. But it was our intent all along to allow for breeder deer to be released from TC3 breeding facilities located in one of these zones if it is authorized by a herd plan that's issued by Texas Animal Health Commission and prepared by both of our agencies. In fact, the comprehensive CWD rules that are in Division 2 of Chapter 65, Subchapter B, do authorize the release of breeder deer from TC3 facilities if it is authorized by a herd plan. But Division 2 does not supersede Division 1. Therefore, we propose to amend the rules in Division 1, again, to allow for TC3 breeding facilities that are located within a containment zone or surveillance zone to release breeder deer, provided that the deer released onto adjoining acreage under the same ownership, that the breeding facility and release site have been in full compliance with the requirements of 65.95 of this title, unless exempted by a herd plan, and the release is specifically authorized in a herd plan that is prepared by this department and Texas Animal Health Commission. Finally, we also propose to clarify which rule prevails in the event of conflicting rules. If any provision of Division 2 conflicts with any other provision of Chapter 65 other than Division 1 of this subchapter, then Division 2 prevails. However, if any provision of Division 2 conflicts with any provision of Division 1, then Division 1 prevails. Simply put, the only rules that would prevail over Division 2, which are the comprehensive CWD rules, would be Division 1, which are the CWD zone rules. Finally, we have received 8 comments in support of this proposal, 2 in opposition to this proposal, but those 2 comments in opposition really weren't germane to this proposal. One of the commenters was opposed to deer breeding of any native species. The other comment had to do with red snapper rules and how we may or may not have articulated those rules in the outdoor annual. So with that, I believe I've just set a record for the shortest presentation on CWD for this commission, and I'll be glad to answer any questions you might have.
Thanks, Mr. Duggan.
Dick, I told you not to make that red snapper comment. No, I'm joking. The question is, on the limitation that you propose, you limited it to, you said, compliance with the requirements of Section 65.95. Is there a reason to limit it to just that one section and not require compliance with all of the rules applicable to deer breeding?
Well, I think that the short answer to that is no. I think 65.95 really is the rules that directly pertain to release sites. They apply to the movement of breeder deer and release site testing requirements. And what we've observed so far is if a release site's not going to be in compliance with the rules, it is that section of the rule that they're not complying with.
But suppose the individual or entity fails or refuses to submit timely reports or to submit information that the staff has reasonably requested. I mean, it seems to me that if you're out of compliance with a substantive rule applicable to deer breeding, I think you ought to have the discretion, maybe not the duty, but the discretion to decline to permit the release.
I think that's good advice, and unless Todd George or any of our legal team would like to further address this, certainly take that under advisement and potentially propose adoption with changes as requested tomorrow.
I'd maybe consider that between today and tomorrow, please.
Any other questions for Mitch? Mitch, thank you. I'll place the chronic wasting disease zone rules and movement of deer rules on the Thursday Commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. With regard to work session item number 9, grant of easement, Somerville County, approximately 9 acres of high voltage transmission line right away at Dinosaur Valley State Park. Do we have any commissioner questions or comments? Okay, I'll place the grant of easement, Somerville County, on the Thursday Commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. For session item number 10, acquisition of land, Bastrop County, approximately 1 acre of Bastrop State Park. Does any commissioner have any questions or comments? Okay, I will also place this on acquisition of land, Bastrop County, on the Thursday Commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. And for item number 11, grant of easement, Randall County, radio tower at Paladuro Canyon State Park. Do we have any commissioner questions or comments? Okay, I'll place this grant of easement, Randall County, on the Thursday Commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. Work session item number 12, which is an update on regulatory litigation regarding red snapper, oysters, and chronic wasting disease. This item will be heard in executive session. Item 13, the Sanjak Battleground State Historic Site Improvements will also be heard in executive session. And item 14 will also be heard in executive session. And 15 as well, which is Personnel Matters, Performance Evaluation of Texas Parks and Wildlife Executive Director. At this time, I'd like to announce that pursuant to the requirements of Chapter 551 Government Code, referred to as the Open Meetings Act, an executive session will be held at this time for the purpose of seeking legal advice under Section 551.071 of the Open Meetings Act, including advice regarding pending or contemplated litigation, deliberation of real estate matters under Section 551.072 of the Open Meetings Act. We will now recess for executive session. Thank you.
We'll now reconvene the regular session of the work session on August 23, 2017 at 2:16 p.m. For work session item 12, update on regulatory litigation, red snapper, oysters, deer breeder litigation, no further action is required at this time. Work session item 13, the San Jacinto Battleground State Historic Site Improvements, no further action required at this time. Work session item number 14, Management Strategy, Marion County, Boundary and Access Issues at Caddo Lake Wildlife Management Area, no further action is required at this time. Work session item number 15, Personnel Matters, Performance Evaluation of the Executive Director, Carter Smith. No further action is required at this time. So, at this point, the commission has completed its work session business, and I declare us adjourned from work session. And we now turn to our annual public meeting and want to welcome each of the members of the public who have chosen to attend today. Good afternoon. The annual public hearing is called to order August 23, 2017 at 2:18 p.m. May I ask everyone to please rise for the posting of the colors by the Texas Buffalo Soldiers.
Detail 10, fight! Permission to post colors, sir.
Permission granted.
Call guard, post!
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Please be seated. For those in our audience who may not be familiar with the Buffalo Soldier program, Buffalo Soldier was the name given to the African-American troops of the United States Army as they served on the western frontier in the late 1800s. Since 1995, the Texas Parks and Wildlife Buffalo Soldiers Program has served as an outreach program of the State Parks Division dedicated to sharing a unique and often overlooked piece of African-American history, as well as other untold stories of our multi-ethnic past. The program provides educational and interpretive experiences that connect underrepresented populations with Texas state parks through heritage interpretation. So we really appreciate those gentlemen coming again today and presenting the colors. At this point, Mr. Smith, before we proceed with any further business in the connection with the annual public meeting, I believe you have a statement to make and comments about how the system will work this afternoon.
I do, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. A public notice of this meeting containing all items on the proposed agenda has been filed in the Office of the Secretary of State, is required by Chapter 551, Government Code, referred to as the Open Meetings Act. I'd like for this fact to be noted in the official record of this meeting, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, Commissioners, let me join all of you in welcoming everybody to our annual public meeting. This is a chance when people from all over the state get to come and address the Parks and Wildlife Commission about any subject that is germane and of interest to you and the Parks and Wildlife Department. And so we appreciate everybody traveling from near and far to join us today. A little bit about the protocol for this afternoon's hearing. Anybody who wants to speak to the commission, we'd respectfully ask that you sign up outside if you haven't already. If you have, at the appropriate time, the chairman will call you forward by name. Please come up to the dais and tell the commission your name, and then everybody will have 2 minutes to address the commission. We've got a green light, red light system. Green means go, yellow means wrap it up, and red means eject. Also, I just would respectfully ask that if you have a phone call or a substantive conversation that you need to have, I'd ask if you step outside the room. Welcome. We're glad you could join us today. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. So at this point, we'll now call those who have signed up to address the commission on matters within the commission's jurisdiction to speak. Each of you will have 2 minutes to speak. And again, the way this operates is your comments are to be addressed to matters within the jurisdiction of the commission and not otherwise. Before I call up the first speaker, I want to give everyone notice that we have two individuals who submitted written comments. The first is Lauren Ice, representing Save Our Springs Alliance, and her written comments are, and I quote, "We continue to oppose the appointment of Kelsey Warren on the TPWD board as an inherent conflict of interest. The practice of energy transfer partners continue to threaten and endanger the parks, water, and wildlife of West Texas. In addition to the border wall threatens wildlife and their habitat, and TPWD should oppose it. Thank you for your consideration, Lauren Ice." I read that verbatim, but I would say that this is an example of a comment that is not within our jurisdiction. This commission does not have the power to appoint the commission or members of the commission, nor to remove them. So let's keep that in mind, that we value comments that are related to business that we can conduct, to the business of this commission. The second written comments come from the Honorable Dennis Bonin, State Representative from Angleton, District 25. And he writes, I am writing to express my concerns regarding the status of our public oyster reefs in Texas. Oysters are a vital component of our coastal landscapes, serving as the foundation of our entire aquatic ecosystem, positively impacting other marine species and keeping our bays healthy by providing numerous ecosystem services. Oysters on Texas public reefs have been under enormous pressure, and I fear that we are at a critical point in the management of this species. My constituents have personally observed commercial oyster fishermen overharvest our bays, destroy our reefs, deplete our oyster supply, and cost taxpayers millions of dollars while repeatedly denying their abuse of our coastal waters. This past March, an oyster company caused a massive marine pileup in my district while, challenging our local elected leaders when asked to rectify the situation. What has happened in Brazoria County, Christmas Bay, and in other sensitive coastal areas is a travesty and should never happen again. I spoke out strongly against these actions during the past legislative regular session and devoted a good deal of time to ensure that we effectively passed House Bill 51. This bill will not only help reduce the pressure on the fishery by establishing the buyback program, but will also achieve some more immediate impacts to the fishery, such as returning oyster shell back into coastal waters and deterring illegal activities by enhancing the penalties for violations, including illegal possession of undersized oysters at the dealer level. However, this bill alone will not be enough to offer public oyster reefs and sensitive coastal zones needed protections. Texas Parks and Wildlife Department must take actions to protect the resource and stop the destruction of reefs that are required to maintain our marine ecosystems. I have reviewed the proposed changes to the statewide oyster fishery proclamation and support these measures. Collectively, we have an obligation to relieve the pressure on this resource and reverse the current trends in this fishery. In my estimation, these additional protections will help foster a sustainable commercial fishery and preserve our public oyster reefs to the greater benefit of Texas. I appreciate your dedication and look forward to our continued collaboration regarding this vital issue. Sincerely, Dennis Bonin. So we appreciate Representative Bonin's comments and particularly his leadership during the session on this and many other issues. So with that, we will now start with those who signed up to make public comments. Again, you have 2 minutes, and remember that your comments should be addressed to something within the scope of the jurisdiction of this commission. And what I'll do is try to call the name of the next speaker so you can be prepared to come up, and this will hopefully go smoothly and efficiently for all. So we'll start with Todd Merendino of Ducks Unlimited, and in line, James Now, also of Texas Ducks Unlimited. Welcome, Mr. Merendino.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Chairman and Commissioners, I'm Bob Filbert, Texas State Chairman for Ducks Unlimited.
I am James Now, Texas State Policy Chair.
And sir, I'm Todd Merendino, Manager of Conservation Programs for Ducks Unlimited.
On behalf of Ducks Unlimited and our over 1 million members and supporters, including nearly 50,000 in Texas, we would like to thank Texas Parks and Wildlife Commission and staff for your efforts on long-term partnership to provide habitat for waterfowl.
The Commission has a long-term recognition that waterfowl are a shared resource, and that waterfowl habitat conservation has to take place not only here in Texas, but also on the breeding grounds in Canada, where most of our waterfowl are produced.
In Texas's annual contribution of state migratory game bird stamp funds to conservation in Canada, for the current year, it stands at $725,000, which makes Texas the top state in the nation. And Texas was the first state to provide $50,000 to Ducks Limited in Mexico. These funds are leveraged by Ducks Limited a minimum of four times, thereby multiplying conservation impact on nesting and also up on the wintering grounds.
In Texas, the Texas Prairie Wetlands Project celebrates 26 years of unique wetland conservation partnership with Texas Parks and Wildlife, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, USDA Natural Resources Conservation Service, private landowners, and Ducks Unlimited working cooperatively to deliver wetlands habitat on the Texas Gulf Coast. It may be the longest-running, most successful private landowner, multiple agency NGO partnership in the country. This past year, Texas Parks and Wildlife increased program funding by $100,000, focused directly on model ducks and their habitat. The Texas Prairie Wetlands Project completed four projects with these funds, restoring grasslands and wetland units, resulting in 694 acres of habitat for model ducks.
Ducks Limited has assisted Parks and Wildlife on their various WMAs and in projects across the state. Most importantly, these projects not only provide waterfowl habitat, but they provide a lot of public hunting opportunities as well.
Working with this commission and many other partners, DU has now conserved over 14 million acres of wetlands in North America. Our special thanks go out to the commission and staff and all Texas waterfowl hunters for your parts in this impressive accomplishment.
Mr. Now, I wanted you to ignore the red light. Since all three of you signed up to speak, please go ahead and finish your comments.
Yes, sir. Good talk.
Okay.
Thank you, sir.
And for the most part, you would like to thank several staff. Obviously, these projects and partnerships are about funding and agreements, but they're also about people on the ground. People to thank are Dave Morrison, Kevin Cry, Jeff Ross, Sean Oldenberger, and Jared Timmons, who are part of the Migratory Game Bird staff, along with Carter Smith, Ross Melichuk, and Clayton Wolf. I'd like to give out a special thanks to various Wildlife Division field staff, some of Lynn Palaszczuk's staff in Region 4, including Mike Rezatek, Matt Nelson, and David Butler in Region 3, some of Corey Mason's staff, or Jeff Gunnels, and also to Matt Samank. And to Miss Debbie Brago, who's retiring at the end of August, we need to give a special thanks to her. She's walked us through a lot of different agreements in this process.
On behalf of Texas Ducks Unlimited, its staff, its 50,000 members, and all waterfowlers, thank you for your unwavering support and for all you do for Texas wetlands and waterfowl across the continent. These are great times for duck hunting, and with your continued support, the best is yet to come. Thank you.
Mr. Filbert, I want to apologize for not mentioning your name. I didn't realize that it was paperclip, and I'm a little slow on the draw. But that, Mr. Bob Filbert, thank you for joining
I appreciate
Mr. Marandino and Mr. Now today.
Sir, everything
thank
that you.
You
do for us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
All right, sir. All right, Ms. Janice Bazanson of the Texas Conservation Alliance, please come to the podium, and please be ready, Mr. Tom Goines.
Good afternoon.
Welcome, Janice.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioners, my name is Janice Bazanson. I'm with Texas Conservation Alliance. Texas Conservation Alliance has been working with the department for 30 or 40 years on many, many projects, and we're very, very aware of the time and resources, personal resources, it takes for it to be a commissioner. And we, first of all, just want to tell you how much we appreciate your service. We particularly appreciate the resolution y'all passed last fall in support of the blue, I want to make sure I get this right, the Blue Ribbon Panel on Sustaining America's Diverse Fish and Wildlife Resources. This was a national panel that included conservationists, hunters, oil and gas industry, business people, and their recommendation was that Congress pass legislation to make $1.3 billion a year available from oil and gas revenues on federal lands to the various states for wildlife projects. And I want to let you know that a coalition is forming that is the Texas Alliance for America's Fish and Wildlife. It will be aligned with the National Alliance for America's Fish and Wildlife to support the Recovering America's Wildlife Act, which will be introduced in Congress, we expect, in September. If this bill passes, it will mean $70 million a year to the state of Texas to work on land acquisition, resource restoration, and we just hope that you will personally help us in supporting this act. Thank you so very much.
Thank you very much. Okay, Mr. Tom Goins, Texas River Protection Association, and please, would Shasta Lusk be in waiting? Welcome, Mr. Goins.
Hi, I'm Tom Goins. I'm president of the Texas Rivers Protection Association, and we're here today to ask if y'all would consider putting us on your regular agenda at a meeting sometime in the near future so that we can present a proposal to create the first linear state park in Texas on the San Marcos River. And now the reason. Our Constitution says that the rivers of Texas are to be highways of trade and travel. And our legislature has said the surface water of Texas is to be held in trust for the people of Texas. Now, I want you to imagine a paved highway someplace where it was X-rated in the afternoon, where you couldn't take your kids there in the afternoon. Everybody understood, no, there's too many drunk college kids. There's too much X-rated music out of the boomboxes, too much nudity. This stretch of Interstate 35 is for the college kids. They need a place to party. We wouldn't do that. Texas wouldn't do that. And yet, the San Marcos River is X-rated. We don't take our kids there. I live there. I used to run a youth camp in the summer. Now we can run it in the fall, winter, and spring, but not in the summer. 3 years ago, we met, and y'all met in Houston, and we said, hey, consider making this river into a linear state park. I thought it turned red, and then it turned yellow. So, and then 2 years ago, we said, give us a task force, study it. And Mr. Jones, on the very first day, said, does anybody have a solution? And I finally raised my hand and said, let's make the river into a linear state park. And he said, the one thing we won't talk about is creating a linear state park. It was off the table. Just give us a chance. Let us have a chance to present that proposal. Thanks. Appreciate it.
Thank you. All right. Next up, Shasta Lusk of Austin, followed by David Sigmund of Hempstead. Is Shasta Lusk in the audience? All right, we'll pass to Mr. David Sigmund of Hempstead, who wants to discuss oysters, followed by Will Kirkpatrick.
Oh, wow. I've never spoken from a public in 40-plus years. My name is David Sigmund. I'm a recreational fisherman. We're here because we must do something to protect the oysters. The proposals, as they are just written, are wrong because it punishes the recreational fishermen. We need to create sanctuary bays. We need to close them from commercial harvest. Mr. Robinson has said that the recreational fisherman creates minimal impact on the resource. He also stated that the shallow bays were where we historically harvest the resource. The reason is we wade to pick up the oysters. I cannot do that in 5 foot deep water. If y'all fence us out, we're through. I mean, I cannot go to Powderhorn Lake and pick up a couple of dozen oysters to take home with me because it will be illegal. It's my proposal to leave the sanctuary bays open to recreational fishermen. Restrict it to only hand harvest. That cuts out the sport oyster boats with the dredge that come in there and dredge them up faster than they can reproduce. The reason for hand harvest is to deter the unlawful sale of the resource. Mr. Robinson said he felt there was a problem with that. But I do not think the recreational fishermen should be punished for the greed and over-harvesting of the commercial industry. That's it.
Thank you, Mr. Sigmund. Mr. Will Kirkpatrick, followed by Tony Gregory.
Good
My name is Will Kirkpatrick. Several years ago, I testified here about the inequities fostered upon our state's vast population and recreational anglers by tournaments. I was informed by a seated commissioner I didn't understand what was actually involved, and he would correct me following that meeting. Director Smith and I encountered each other outside the meeting, both recognizing a unstructured meeting in the hallway was not advisable. Director Smith is going to set up a later meeting. But the commissioner and TPWD official met me in the hall and proceeded to critique my feelings and knowledge of for-profit tournaments. I spent 31 years with four divisions, the original Bell system in nine states, several seas locations, fished in 19 states and three countries with my first Bassmasters tournament in 1970. 1971, I joined the pro staff of the nation's largest lure manufacturer, which I'm still with today. 1974, I began a continuous 44-year part-time, full-time freshwater guide service, which as of today, I've spent $3,400 for that license. In 1989, Stephen F. Austin State University requested I set up a freshwater fishing school, which I still conduct today. For 15 years, TPWD officials, personnel were given free time at these schools with liberty to explain their connection to our state's outdoors. Texas Parks and Wildlife programs are license fees and use fees plus other tax supports. And all the lodging and meal costs were paid by me. I donated $3,000 to a TPWD catch and release study, $750 for an economic study on Rayburn. Your packet has previous information I provided dating back to 1995 and two editorials from the Fishing Tackle Realtor, which is our fishing industry's Bible. And if you read these, you'll find them very interesting. TPWD doesn't know today how many for-profit freshwater fishing tournaments are held yearly in Texas, nor the number of anglers participating and the amount of monies involved, yet Mom and Dad and the kids still pay the majority of the TPWD license fees. The information from the hallway meeting was incorrect and is still wrong, and I'm still waiting for a meeting, and if any of you want to have a meeting, we can get the information together and provide it any kind of a meeting you want.
Thank you, Mr. Kirkpatrick. Next up, Tony Gregory, Battleship Texas Foundation, followed by Ken Baker.
Thanks for this opportunity to be here. I'm Tony Gregory, Chairman of the Board at Battleship Texas Foundation. I'm a native Houstonian. Like a lot of native Houstonians, I spent time on the ship as a young boy. I'm a little unique in that I'm the third generation of the Gregory family to serve on the Battleship Texas Foundation. I'm here with my esteemed colleague, Bruce, who left you a paperweight made out of steel from the ship. So I was just wondering if Bruce came up here if I get 4 minutes. I'm okay.
Battleship Texas, speak.
Battleship Texas is in a state of emergency due to continual multiple leaks in the hull. A series of major leaks have breached the hull beginning in June of 2012, November of 2016, and June of this year, when it leaked enough that it listed 8 degrees to starboard. We spent about $2.7 million to fix these leaks. So we are here to advocate the saving of the ship. If we said to ourselves, okay, let's just forget it, let's abandon ship, we would still encounter some significant costs to scrap it. We have estimates from reputable shipyards where the cost to scrap it because of environmental concerns is significant. We would rather be on the team that saves the ship, and the incremental cost between scrapping it and saving it could be less than we think. So in return on investment for investing in saving the ship would certainly be a lot better. Saving it is the right time, is the right thing to do. It's the right time to do it. At this moment, when our history seems to be under attack, saving the Battleship Texas seems like something we could all agree to. So we're here to request the formation of a Blue Ribbon Committee to decide the future of the ship. And we ask for your support in this committee with the task of offering recommendations to the state leadership and the 86th Texas legislature as to the best plan of action for saving the ship. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Ken Baker, followed by Eric DeLuna.
Parks and Water Commissioners, thank you for allowing me to address y'all today. My name is Ken Baker. I am retired Captain State Game Warden with some 41 years of service. I will come forward with some facts and personal observations on what was the proud men and women in law enforcement division have had to endure in the field for some 4.5 years since I retired from county. Budgets where there were no replacement for patrol vehicles, for worn out ones, vast numbers of units in excess of 160,000 miles, so bad that wrecked and inoperable patrol units were badly needed to salvage parts, just to keep ones in the field running. A budget where wardens are not afforded a decent uniform replacement schedule. A budget where patrol vessels costing more than $250,000 of a $6 million safe boat fleet sitting on trailers for a year because there's lack of engine replacements, no funds for other parts to make them operative, no funds for special 4x4 vehicles to mobilize these special units, district officers that are so small that there's no evidence rooms, you have to put the safes in the bathrooms. A division where there's no budget to install law enforcement equipment, you have to utilize the marine mechanics, and the list goes on and on. But I would like to commend Carter Smith and the Parks and Wildlife Commissioners in addressing these issues and providing support and budget increases in those areas, especially in the next budget in terms of capital and operation funds. I thank you for support, and thank you.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate that. Okay, we next have up Eric DeLuna, followed by Douglas Boyd.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Eric DeLuna, and I'm here to voice my opinion and concerns on the current state of the Texas state parks, specifically the future of Balmoray State Park, the surrounding parks in West Texas, and the Rio Grande Valley. Recently, I took a trip to West Texas and was able to see firsthand the development happening all around. The drive and the scenery consisted mostly of oil rigs, oil flares, and oil tankers. I come here today as a concerned Texan seeking answers as to what will and can be done to protect the water and wildlife found in the region. Tourism is still the main driving force of the area, and I'm afraid to think what will happen when the tourism stops because of excess drilling within the surrounding communities and, God forbid, an accidental spill. I come here concerned as to what will remain of the residents, the businesses, the agriculture, and the tourism with everything happening out west. Furthermore, I ask what will happen to the endangered species of fish, the pupfish, the freshwater catfish that are only reside in these areas, once fracking, and if it does happen, contaminate the 15 million gallons of water that pump out of Balmoray. I question if there has been enough research in finding out the dangers of fracking so close to this oasis in West Texas. Furthermore, down south in the valley, there's a different type of concern. The proposition of a border wall that will tear right through Benson's Rio Grande Valley State Park. The communities surrounding depend on the state park for the revenue produced through ecotourism. A study by A&M College Station says that over 125,000 tourists from all around the world come to enjoy the natural wonders and wildlife of the region. This translates to roughly $400 million a year going directly to the local communities. It provides unparalleled birding experiences to those that visit, with rare songbirds migrating through each year. Additionally, it is one of the very few riparian zones that exist along the Rio Grande, so it is imperative that we protect this one-of-a-kind area. In conclusion, I quote the mission statement for the Texas State Parks and Wildlife Department. It reads, to manage and conserve the natural and cultural resources of Texas and provide hunting, fishing, and outdoor recreation opportunities for the use of enjoyment of present and future generations. Future generations. I myself am 24 years old. You guys will probably be long gone by the time I turn 50.
But I will be responsible for these parks. I mean, all of us, the young people here, there's children here. And we care, and something's not right in West Texas. Something's not right in the valley. People here sitting that are directly involved with this. And what are we doing? What is, me as a taxpayer, I want to know, what are we doing as Texans to fix these issues? Thank you very much.
Thank you. Douglas Boyd, followed by Brian Tickle.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Commissioners, for this opportunity to speak. My name is Douglas Boyd. I'm a recreational fisherman. I've been fishing the Texas waters for over 60 years with my father and grandfather. I was born in Galveston, so I know the coast. I want to thank you for how well the state has managed the marine resources. We have abundant trout, we have abundant redfish, we have abundant flounder, and we're doing even better with flounder now. Because you care about habitat and the science that supports healthy ecosystems, Texas has enjoyed great offshore fishing and inshore fishing. You have also had the foresight to lengthen the seasons for the state waters offshore, and we don't have to fight a derby every year on 3 days, 2 days, or 5 days to fish for red snapper. In my opinion, your management team has been very fair with the needs of private boat anglers and charter for hire and headboat operators. I want to thank you for your reef building program off the coast of Texas. I encourage you to support in concept and with budget dollars additional research in reporting so that we can get better data and we will know more about who is fishing and how many fish we are catching. I encourage you to seriously consider the current amendments before the Gulf Council that would establish state management for all recreational fishermen out to 200 miles. The most difficult part of state management will be the consideration of allocations. That is a very difficult part of that whole process, and your managers are very capable of that negotiation. The biggest part of that is going to be the problem with most of the red snapper being to the Western Gulf, and the other part is the abundance of fishermen in the Eastern Gulf. And finally, I'd like to say thank you to Carter Smith, Ross Melinchek. Thank you for Robin Rikers. Thank you for Lance Robinson. These guys have done a great job for the state of Texas, and I commend them. Thank you, sir.
Mr. Boyd, thank you. I did want to respond. You said you hoped that this commission would take a look, I think, at regional management of the Gulf, and I think it's we have previously very publicly stated that we are very much in favor of regional management, but that's going to require some changes in Washington.
Yes, sir.
I just want you are aware that.
Okay. Yes, sir, I am.
All right. Thank you for your comment.
These new amendments are a little bit different than the last one that came before the Gulf Council, and so it will take some additional consideration on your part, I think. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Brian Tickle, followed by John Gosden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Brian Tickle. I'm the legislative liaison for the Access Fund. I'm also a board member of the Texas Climbers Coalition and a board member of the State Parks Advisory Committee, and also a lifelong Texan and a rock climber. And I haven't prepared anything formally today. I just want to speak in thanks to the department for the work that they've been doing at the Chinati Mountains and planning for Kronkowski and Powderhorn and Palo Pinto. And our organizations have followed the legislative session pretty closely, so we're pretty aware of the challenges that the department's going to face over the next, the 2018-19 biennium. And I'm really just here today to offer my support to the department in any way that I can, because it would just be a shame to see those projects delayed any further because of funding at the session.
Well, we appreciate your support of our park system, and I think everybody up here is aware that our park visits are continuing to skyrocket.
Yes.
As confirmation of how important parks are to this state and to its citizens. And you can help us by letting your legislators know how important they are and urge them to help us with more funding, which we certainly
will, absolutely.
But thank you.
All right, thank you.
All right, Mr. John Gosden, followed by Jerry Sharp.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the Commission. My name is John Gosden, and I'm currently the president of the Texas for State Parks organization. So appreciate that little introduction that you get about the popularity of our state parks these days. The Texas for State Parks is a 501c3 nonprofit organization working statewide with friends groups at over half of the state parks. So we have about 50 friends groups that work hand in glove with staff at our state parks to provide a source of volunteers to help with all of those services that can be done by a volunteer group. These volunteers have contributions of talent, skills, and services that help provide a better experience for those visitors that do come to our state parks. We look back a couple of years ago, and there were about 900,000 volunteer services provided, and that equates to almost 500 full-time equivalents that are provided at no taxpayer dollars, but just those who love the parks and are there to help provide the visitor services for those who visit there. With us being stressed for dollars in the years ahead, the Texas for State Parks has the goals of trying to continue to build and support the growth of new friends groups, and also to provide training and technical assistance to the existing friends groups we have. I know we have some challenges ahead, and we just want to be there to help provide a spotlight and also support that we can to make the visitor experience as best as it can for visitors to our state parks. Thank you.
Mr. Gosden, thank you and your team for all you do for the park system. All right, Jerry Sharp, followed by Carl Goss.
Good afternoon, Honorable Commissioners. I represent myself and am here today to voice my concerns regarding threats that currently face our parks and other public use lands. My focus in particular is Balmoray State Park. In the past 3 days, there have been three earthquakes, with the largest one of magnitude 3.2, with its epicenter approximately 35 miles from Balmoray State Park as the crow flies. The immediate concern is the threat of these and future earthquakes, which inadvertently might affect the unique karst and fault line features in which San Solomon Springs flows out from. To further expand, possible seismic activity potentially may reroute the flow of spring water to the CCC-built pool, which provides recreation and irrigation to many of those in the surrounding area and the state of Texas. Not to mention the importance of the desert senegas within Balmoray State Park as one of the few areas that is home to two federally listed endangered species found nowhere else on Earth. I understand that this is not a TPWD jurisdiction, but let me ask you this. If a wildfire burns your neighbor's house, would you wait to fight the blaze only when it touches your fence? It is imperative that a stronger stance be taken to address these issues and concerns of citizens and fellow neighbors. I trust this commission's better judgment in understanding the scale of this threat and others that face TPWD and this great state. Thank you for your attention and time commitment to TPWD.
Thank you, Mr. Sharp. Up next, Carl Goss, followed by Marika Alderink. Hope I pronounced that correctly. Thank you.
Hello, Commission. I'm glad to be able to speak to you today. I have wanted to speak to you for several years, and have an annual meeting to do that makes it a little bit more difficult. And one of the things I'd like to ask you to consider is to do that more often, maybe even more places around the state, so that more people could provide input to how the community feels about the parks and wildlife. And I'm a big supporter of Texas Parks and Wildlife, and I've been an annual member since I could make that decision. and visited not all the parks yet, but several of them I've been to many, many times, and appreciate our parks, proud of our state for what we do with our parks, brag about our parks, take my friends, my family. You know, it's part of our life, you know, being part of these parks. One of the things I love about our parks is example of stewardship to our land, to our water, to our air, to our wildlife. And I think that as a state, as a parks department, that we project that into our community, the values of our state into our community. And this is the opportunity for our community to project our values to the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. And I know I've seen, you know, what goes on in the parks and involvement in the parks and everything that we do and, you know, the annual fair that we have here. I love that. My daughters have been to that all their life. And I know that we have a balance between commercial interest and community interest that we have to consider all the time. I mean, the commercial interest in many ways supports so much of what we do in this state and so much what the Parks and Wildlife Department does. But those commercial interests have to be in line with community interest. And I think the community interest has got to come first. And being good stewards of our state, of our land, our water, our air, our wildlife, not just in our parks, but what we project into our state, how do we treat our land, our water, our air, and our wildlife? That's what we do. That's what we as a community are here representing to you, what's important to us. And that is important to us. And with the rapid advancements that we're making in sustainable energy, both efficiency and the economy of it, I just ask that as a commission that we look at everything that we're doing in regards to parks and into our state and what we're showing on how we take care of our land, of our water, and our air, because I don't think what's happening in the oil industry is the best use of our land, our water, our air. I don't think it's helping our community, that we have other options now that are coming on quickly and becoming more and more viable quickly. In everything that you look at, please lean in to sustainable energy. Lean away from anything that's consuming our resources and hurting our planet. Thank you.
Thank you. Next up is Marika Alderink. Again, I hope I pronounced that correctly. If you what?
If I speak first here.
Well, do you want to wait and I can take you at the end? Or do you want to... The problem is we've got a lady here who transcribes the meeting, and she needs the microphone, and we're happy to move you around in terms of order if that might help you. Your daughter can come up with you if you want. Or son, I can't tell quite yet, other than blonde hair.
My son has very long, beautiful hair.
Okay, sorry, I didn't thought I'd better cover myself.
Well, some people have already stated this more educatedly than I, but I'm here to represent my concerns about what's happening around Balmoray. Just from a layman, tourist, mama's point of view, I want to make sure that we're doing everything we can to protect the water and protect that place as a place I can bring my kids and a place that, like, there's history there, which I really love. I love that we have a place that we can go that has been open for 100 years, that we can see pictures of great-grandparents swimming and such. And so I want to make sure that we're doing everything we can to make sure that the fracking isn't going to affect the water there. Thanks.
Thank you very much. The next speaker is Spence Collins, followed by Andrew Lucas.
Good afternoon, commissioners. We thank you. I thank you for allowing me to speak here today. I'm speaking as a recreational fisherman, in particular a coastal recreational fisherman today. I reside in Travis County here, but have a place in Corpus Christi on the Laguna Madre, the Upper Laguna Madre there, and grew up in Houston fishing Galveston Bay, San Luis Pass, the surf there. And my dad grew up in Port Arthur, and he's got an affinity towards seafood gumbo, and everybody knows you have to have good oysters and seafood gumbo, and we'll talk about that tomorrow, I guess, too.
Does he know Mr. Scott?
I'm not sure.
He likes seafood gumbo, too, a lot.
Well, good. I'm glad. I'm here today to talk about some red snapper and also give kudos to the Coastal Fisheries Department and the job that they've been doing overall, and in particularly on this recent red snapper issue, as you well know, a couple months ago when it was proposed from the feds that they open up this summer season to a three-day fishing weekend. I think on behalf of the Coastal Fisheries Department, they made it happen quickly, as y'all did as well. And so just wanted to say, as a recreational fisherman, thank you for making that happen and allowing us guys to get offshore. As you know, in when the feds hand down a two-day or a three-day or a nine-day or 11-day season, whatever that may be, as they have over the past years, typically that's in June, and that doesn't is not real conducive to offshore fishing. So we need to come up with a better solution, as you stated earlier, and I'm aware of that y'all's board is supporting that, and I continue to ask you collectively as a board and individually as a Texan to do what you can to lobby the feds, whether that be the fishery managers and or the elected, especially the elected officials, to make that happen. In regards to the red snapper there, when that does happen, we need to get obviously a little bit more recreational fisherman time. With the commercial guys taking, you know, half the quota and us taking the other half and only getting that two-day season, we need to figure out ways, if we can get the state control, to get, you know, a more available days for the recreational fishermen to get offshore in a time period of the year that is conducive to offshore fishing. So please keep that in mind as you move forward with that red-hot issue there. And, of course, the Coastal Fisheries Department is well-equipped to manage that if it indeed gets handed over to state management. They've got a wonderful track record, as Doug Boyd mentioned, with redfish, the speckled trout, and more recently the flounder. So I thank you for your time today, and I thank you for your service to the Texas outdoorsmen and outdoorswomen.
Well, I appreciate your comments, and I think then Commissioner Scott wants to say something, that I would encourage you and any others who share your views to consider reaching out to members of Congress, and in particular Congressman Graves in Louisiana, and then Texas, members of the Texas delegation, and let them know how you feel about
the
management of the fisheries, but because that makes a difference. And and of course you're right in that our staff, Robin Rikers and his team and Carter Smith, did pull off a pretty amazing feat this year to get the additional days that we got for the summer. So you're correct in lauding them. Yes. Commissioner Scott.
He caught most of the points I was going to make. There's no question this commission supports us having control of our own destiny. We're working on our friends to the east and think that they will hopefully get on the same program, because we got the most red snapper between the two of us and all the rest of it put together.
Right.
But it's an issue that is constantly being worked on. What Ralph said is accurate. This is going to take a lot of letter writing, and it's going to take a lot of people making their views known to Washington about what needs to go on in our Gulf.
Yeah,
thank you.
I'll do my part.
Thank you. All right. Next up, Andrew Lucas, followed by Graham Davis.
Good afternoon. My name is Andrew Lucas. I'm here on behalf of the people, the public land, and the wild places of Texas.
I would first like to thank TPWD for the service they provide the state. Without you, citizens would have little access to the outdoors. Thank you to the rangers, interpreters, wardens, park police, scientists, and all employees, patrons, and volunteers for your daily service. You are the ones who make it happen. Thank you for your access to the outdoors and the examples you've set for private land management. Thank you for your stewardship and your efforts in land conservation. I truly mean it. The state has been trusted with safeguarding the public land that both the state and its citizens have worked to create. These are special natural and cultural places that have been sanctioned for future generations. I'm here to address some very serious threats facing our private lands and public lands because these liberties are currently under siege. On my recent trip to Mission, Texas, in the valley, I found the border community hand in hand for a future without walls. To my disbelief, I learned that plans for a wall were already underway. It seems that the strategy for quickly constructing a wall has been to target wildlife sanctuaries and public land trusts. The National Butterfly Center received no notice before work crews were found extending roads and clearing land on private property. The wall, which is being raised along the levee, plans to split through Santa Ana National Wildlife Refuge, La Lomita Mission, as well as Bentner Rio Grande Valley State Park. Who will want to visit these places when you need a passport to get past the visitor center? In reality, it's likely that these places will no longer be accessible. My question is, if our public land is being violated here, what is in store for Seminole Canyon State Park, Falcon State Park, Casablanca State Park, Big Bend Ranch State Park, and Black Gap Wildlife Management Area, to mention a few? This wall will hurt our community, our wildlife, our tourism, and state image. It breaks my heart that border security means spending billions of dollars to send walls through these beautiful places. It breaks my heart that making America great again means drilling thousands of holes through the life-giving waters of Balmoray. What will happen to Balmoray State Park, our most visited park, and other desert water sources in 20 years when a lack of water laws have pumped springs dry and underground networks have been spoiled by thousands of holes and waste pits drilled through the delicate system, taking the water and returning it to the ground as poison? It takes one overpressured valve, Mr. Warren. With my own eyes, I've seen the construction of drilling rigs in the Davis Mountains and the orange horizon where there was once darkness from the vantage point of the McDonald Observatory. It seemed all the people I talked with were terrified by what is happening. I speak with the hope that you hear me because we need our parks to stand with the people and the land whom you represent. Help us defend these places. I call on the TPW Commission to publish a resolution which seeks to protect the sanctity of its borders, to henceforth state that no wall shall be built through our parks. I encourage TPW to stand publicly against these attacks and our lands. I believe all TPW employees should be allowed the First Amendment right to speak up against these threats. We cannot stand idle by as our sacred places are ruined. Please, we need your help. With love and respect, I call on the Commission to protect the natural and cultural resources of Texas for present and future generations.
Thank you. Graham Davis, followed by Colleen Mulvey.
Hi, thank you for hearing my thoughts today. My name is Graham Davis. I'm just a private citizen. I'm interested in wolf reintroduction efforts in Texas, specifically in Texas, and also the rest of the country. Wolf reintroduction is a contentious issue, as you guys well know, and it's currently against the law in Texas. So I'm not here to ask that we launch any kind of wolf reintroduction effort in Texas. That would be fruitless and ill-informed. The fact is we have no idea what impact that would have, positive or negative. I've done a little digging. We have no current research, about wolves in Texas since they were extirpated in the last century. The Texas Parks and Wildlife Department doesn't have research, current research on wolves, and the Borderlands Research Institute doesn't have any research on wolves in Texas as well. I have two specific requests for the commission. The first is that the commission ask the department to do some research on the scientific impact of having a robust Mexican gray wolf population in Texas. And the second would be to provide guidelines on the type of research that would be helpful to the Texas Department of Wildlife and the Commission should private individuals or organizations wish to fund and conduct this research on their own. So what would be helpful for you to make policy decisions? Wolves are extirpated in Texas, and it's against the law, so why should we spend resources on researching wolves to begin with? The Mexican gray wolf range used to include West Texas. There's been several reintroduction efforts. The most notable is in Yellowstone that has restored damaged ecosystems. There are current efforts in Arizona and New Mexico, and also Mexico to our south, specifically around the Mexican gray wolf, and other efforts, North Carolina, Wyoming, and Idaho, of other types of wolf species. Given the lack of research available to lawmakers and policymakers today, it's unlikely that our existing laws and policies reflect actual science. And so I think we're missing an opportunity to understand the impact of having wolves in Texas in the following areas: ecology revitalization, such as riparian areas, species balancing, such as balancing of coyote species, foxes, and grazer populations, ecotourism, there could be tremendous benefits, and also hunting. I know some big game hunters who would be interested in hunting wolves. So I've laid out my research requests. I think there's a number of things that we can do specifically in the research area. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Davis. Colleen Mulvey, you're welcome to speak. You've listed in your issue Kelsey Warren. As I previously said, if you're up here to complain about his appointment, that's not what this meeting's for.
Yes, sir. Is Mr. Warren able to step down?
Do you have comments that you wish to make concerning matters that we have jurisdiction over? If it's here again to complain about Mr. Warren's appointment, that's really not relevant.
Well, sir, I think it's very relevant because he is able to step down. There is action that this council can take to make itself more able to fulfill its duties.
Again, are your comments directed to his appointment and his sitting on this board?
My comments are directed to his ability to fulfill the position that he has taken.
Okay. That's really outside the scope of this meeting, so I'd ask you to please stand down.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. The last speaker is Alyssa Tharp.
Thank you, Commissioners. My name is Alyssa Tharp. I'm a resident here of Austin, Texas, and this would be the third meeting that I've come to with the Texas Parks and Wildlife. I spoke before, particularly relating to the J.D. Murphy Wildlife Management Area. My concerns are largely related to climate change and actual fulfillment of the mission of the Parks and Wildlife to manage and conserve natural resources and cultural resources of Texas, to provide outdoor recreation opportunities for use and enjoyment for present and future generations. Climate change is a very serious threat to the enjoyment of Texas parks in future generations, and also in current generations, because we see heat indexes in 103 and 107 causing a lot of people inability to even go out to enjoy our state parks currently. And we know that these issues will continue to rise. And so my request to you today are that you assess the scientific predictions of the impacts of climate change on Texas, particularly with state parks, that you look at the National Science Climate Reports previously and the public records of the one that's currently in review with the administration on the federal level, and that you recognize or make some kind of policies as a Parks Commission with regards to acknowledging the climate science reported that humans are responsible already for 1 to 1.3 degrees raise in the global average temperature. I request that you assess goals for reducing greenhouse gas emissions from the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department operations, that you assess how you can limit or completely phase out fossil fuel extraction on park lands, particularly the 20 lands and 11 wildlife management areas where drilling is currently happening, and that you assess greenhouse gas climate impacts in assessments for future proposed projects on state park lands and wildlife management areas, that you set goals to also look at environmental justice issues, the fact that we have a situation where, as with the wildlife management J.D. Murphy area, you have a petrochemical corporation in areas where we see severe injustices in who is impacted by pollution across the Texas Gulf, and they are coming to the Parks and Wildlife Commission and forcing throughways in park areas in order to perpetuate what is actually a violation of civil rights law on the federal level, where we see an unjust amount of pollution in neighborhoods of color, particularly African-American neighborhoods in Beaumont and Port Arthur. That is a concern to you because the people in these areas have heightened rates of cancer, heightened rates of asthma, and they might look to Texas parks and wildlife to get away from pollution and yet would go to find more extraction in these parklands. Our entire culture is at risk because we're so dependent upon fossil fuels, and now is the time to do something different about it. I also have concern that parks commissioners are profiteers who use and leverage wealth.
Would you please wrap up? Your time is up and has been up for about a minute.
So I request that anyone who's a profiteer of the fossil fuel industry rescind from voting on issues about fossil fuel throughways in parklands. Thank you.
Is there anyone who signed up to speak whose name has not been called? Yes, sir. Did you sign up, sir?
Yes, I did, sir.
Okay. Well, please come forward and address the commission. I apologize that we overlooked you.
It's all right. I've been lost in the shuffle before. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and Commissioners. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak here today. My comments are off the cuff and miscellaneous. I have had the good fortune to interface with your management team over a decade or two, and I just want to take this opportunity to step up and in no order of importance, mention a few folks I've had the good fortune to communicate with. Carter Smith and Robin Rikers, Lance Robinson and Mark Lingo, and Brandy Reeder. I've had a wonderful association with those folks. They represent this department extremely well, and I echo the comments of my good friends Spent Collins and Doug Boyd on their message to you this morning or this afternoon. And I guess except for my retriever did want me to affectionately mention Warden Carmen Miranda down in the land cut for her intercept that he enjoyed so much. So thank you this afternoon.
Before you step down, just so we have this for the record here, would you give us your address,
yes,
please?
I'm an avid coastal fisherman and duck hunter from Corpus Christi, Texas.
And would you just give us your whatever your preferred address is, whether it's residence or business?
Sure.
You're in timeout. Okay, we have it now. Thank you very much. Is there anyone else that D overlooked? Okay, that being the case, on behalf of my colleagues, I want to thank those of you who took time to appear today and share your thoughts. And I would say one of you, I think, commented that you hoped we would hold this annual meeting at other locations. In the past, we've had it in Houston, San Antonio, Fort Worth, and this November we're going to have our meeting in East Texas at Lufkin. So we are going to attempt to try to move some of the meetings outside of Austin and give others around the state a chance to come and appear. So with that, the commission has completed its business, and I declare us adjourned. Thank you very much.